Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare. It is September 21st, 8 a.m., Hearing Room B, and I would like to welcome my colleagues, Senator Cruz and Senator Knope, and hopefully Senator Steiner Hayward will be here shortly. And, of course, my staff, Sandy and Debbie. We'd like to open with a presentation on comprehensive primary care, the initiative. And do you all come up as a panel? Ron Stock, Jane Conley, Bob Glockman, and Mary Jemper.
We have to bring another chair up. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Ron Stock. I'm a clinical innovation consultant with the Oregon Rural Practice-Based Research Network, otherwise known as ORPRIN. ORPRIN and Care Management Plus have been providing the technical assistance and learning for the predecessor to Comprehensive Primary Care Plus for the last 3.5 years, and so we're happy to be here. My job this morning, prior to my colleagues talking, is to provide you with a high-level overview of the Comprehensive Primary Care Plus initiative by CMMI. It's really a program that will change the way primary care in Oregon will be delivered and paid for. As usual, there are a lot of details with this program, and so we've provided, hopefully you have a copy of the slides with you that you can refer back to. I'm not going to get into great detail for a lot of them, but you can look at these slides in the future. So what are we trying to accomplish with this program, both CMMI and for us in Oregon? First of all, we want to achieve the triple aim, and that's ought to be core to whatever we do. And this program really attempts to do that. This program also is a way or a means to provide the resources to primary care practices in the state to improve and advance care delivery and the payment to allow practices to provide more comprehensive care. And by that I mean, in comprehensive care, it's defined as not just the medical needs, but also behavioral health needs and begin to address some of the social needs that primary care practices can address in their communities. The third objective of this program, Comprehensive Primary Care Plus, is the understanding that CMMI has is that practices are at different stages in terms of redesigning their practices and advancing different payment methodologies in their practices. And this program actually allows them through two tracks, one for those practices that are just getting started, may have begun to redesign their practices but need some help and some resources to do that, and then track two for those practices that have really been working on redesigning their practices, on implementation of changes in their practices through the last 3.5 years, and the CPC Classic program allows them to move even further. But the fourth objective, one that I added, is that really this program is an opportunity for us in Oregon to engage multiple payers, including the CCOs. And I would say also engage payers and clinicians to align payment, quality metrics, and the way primary care is delivered in Oregon. So fortunately, Oregon went through a competitive process. Payers applied for this, and Oregon became one of 14 states and regions in the country. We're going to kind of hold down the post in the western part of the country with this initiative. But through this competitive process, there were 14 regions and states that were selected to participate in this program. This is a five-year model beginning in this January. It's the largest primary care model implementation in the history, in U.S. history. There are 14 states, as I mentioned. There are over 5,000 practices, 20,000 physicians, and 25 million people will be impacted by this implementation of this model. And in Oregon, each state and region has a core cohort of payers who have been selected and approved to be participating in this program. In Oregon, we have 15 payers who have been selected and approved by CMS. This provides you the list of those in Oregon. What I can say is that the initiative Was really in two phases. The recruitment of the payers occurred in the first phase, and these are the payers that are listed. And in just a few minutes, you're going to hear from a couple of them to talk about what they have experienced. And then the second phase is really the recruitment of practices. And the recruitment of practices can only occur within those 14, if those practices are within the 14 regions. And in Oregon, just in the state of Oregon. The practice eligibility, they're actually pretty simple criteria, the eligibility. The practice needs to have at a minimum of 150 Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries within their practice. So obviously that does limit it to the professions of family practice, geriatric medicine, and internal medicine, and does exclude, for the most part, pediatrics from and pediatricians from participating in that program. It also, the second major eligibility criteria is that the practices through the application process had to show that they were able to proceed with care management, workflow processes, patient access, and quality improvement practices within their practice. Some practices are very early in that. Others have been doing this for a number of years and really need to advance that. As I mentioned, the program design has two tracks. Track one, for those practices who are really ready and prepared to move forward and will now get the resources to move with forward with redesign of their practice. And then track two, for those practices that have been in this for a while. And what's interesting about, and what's great, I think, in terms of track two is that the focus is really going to be on those that have more complex needs and complex require a complex system to manage those needs. So for all the practices, they will be required to participate in a care delivery redesign that will be supported both through peer learning and through TA for these practices in five primary care functional areas. They will need to be start participating over the next 5 years in looking at how they can provide care 24/7, how they begin to understand who are in their practice, begin to risk stratify them according to their risks, and then begin to have care management processes to manage those that are in the higher risk category. They'll need to begin to work with hospitals and emergency rooms to around communication of patients coming and going out of those facilities. The practices will be required to have a patient and family advisory council in their practices to help inform them as to what the best ways in which they can deliver care for that population. The second major piece of the initiative is the payment methodology and changes in the practice and how it gets paid for delivering care. And two things I want you to come away with this slide. Number one, the payment methodology differs according to track one or track two. So in track two, for those practices that are taking care of a more complex population of folks, will be getting more money in terms of supporting care management in terms of particularly for those who are very complex in Medicare, for example, those with dementia. There is a special category for payment for them. So the differences, there will be differences between track one and track two. The second thing I want you to take away from this slide is that there are three basic methods that are being proposed here or will be implemented in this payment methodology. Number one, there will be a care management fee that will be prospectively paid to the practices to develop the care management services that the practices will be required. Number two, there will be an underlying payment system. So there's a fee schedule for patients that come to the practice. Under track one, they'll get their usual fee for service, at least in the Medicare population. In track two, you'll be seeing what's being called a hybrid payment methodology, where practices will begin to receive money prospectively to manage their population of patients, but then their fee for service will be reduced because they'll have the money up front to manage the population, thus encouraging them to do more activity proactively, maybe out in facilities and in the community. And then the third payment methodology will be a quality and cost incentive payment, not unlike the quality incentive measure payment that is currently in CCOs, although this is different in that practices will receive their money for the quality payment up front, and then at the end of the year that will be reconciled, and if they don't meet the benchmarks, then they will need to give that money back. So finally, just the timeline. This has been a very short timeline for CPC Plus. It was just initiated in April. The payers were recruited and approved, and the regions were approved end of July, first part of August. The practices needed were recruited in August and completed their application on September 15th. We hope to know who the practices are participating in November, and the program gets kicked off in January 1st. I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues here, who will talk a little bit about what it's like to practice in this kind of model.
And remember, there's 6 minutes to
yes.
go. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jane Conley. I'm the clinic administrator for Springfield Family Physicians. My role this morning is to try to give you a sense of how this program transformed our practice. 65 clinics in Oregon, including ours, participated in the Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative. We were one of them. Our clinic received about $250,000 a year in alternative payment for case management fees for the patients that were covered under the participating providers. It's important for you to understand that all of this money went towards patient care. None of it went to the physicians as payment to the physicians. We had to prove what we did with the money. With the additional income, we hired a registered nurse, several in-office mental health professionals, two transition of care planners, and an additional medical assistant for each provider. Our RN functions as a diabetic educator for our patients. That's been extremely transformational because she has met with most every diabetic who is out of control in our practice and has had a 70% success rate in lowering their A1Cs after visiting with her. These are patients who had no success previously with our care in lowering their blood sugar levels. Our mental health professionals have become an integral part of the team. Our providers can't imagine working without them any longer. Last year, we referred 700 patients to them in our clinic. For the past 4 years, our transition of care managers have contacted 100% of all patients who have visited the ED or left the hospital, and that has also had fantastic results. Our second medical assistant with each physician allows them to do a far better job with each provider. They're actually prospectively looking at who's coming in, scrubbing the charts, looking for care gap opportunities, seeing who's due for their mammograms, colonoscopies, those kinds of things. We actually know that before the patient arrives, and we can address it at the visit. These are services we could never do before because we simply aren't paid for doing them or they are severely underfunded. So the results of these changes have been pretty significant. In the 2 years between the first quarter of 2014 and the first quarter of 2016, our practice has added 104 Medicare patients. We have decreased per patient expenditures by 5.5%. We've decreased hospital admissions by 8%. We've decreased ED visits by 12.5%. We've decreased 30-day readmissions by 13%.
Amazing.
We've seen a huge improvement in the patient care, and we can imagine far more things that we can do. It's just the tip of the iceberg if we have continued. We're excited about the possibilities of CPC Plus, and we want to be one of the clinics in this particular project. Unfortunately, our CCO has chosen not to participate, Trillium. And because more than 25% of our patients have Medicaid handled through the CCO, we're not sure that we will be accepted into the CPC Plus program. We hope so, but we're not sure.
So the metrics are different. The OHA metrics and CMS metrics, or is that correct? So you don't have mental health, you don't have drug and alcohol metrics.
So some of the metrics, CMS has a different set of metrics. There may be some that have some overlap in terms of behavioral health measures and medical health measures, but that's one of the pieces that's still being negotiated in terms of what will be the actual measures. Bob?
One of the things I think it's important to recognize
Introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, sure. I'm Bob Gluckman. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Providence Health Plans, and I'll be providing a little testimony later. One of the things I think it's really important to recognize is that with different segments of the population, different quality measures are appropriate. So you're going to have some overlap, and you're going to have some unique features that are really specific to certain populations. So I think that you want to get as much alignment as possible, but there may be things that are unique to the OHA and to the Medicaid population that may not be as applicable to other populations.
Yeah, and an example of that is some of the measures in the CMS program here are around falls in the elderly, around medication management in the elderly, and those are not ones that you might typically see in the others. So.
One of the things we've been attempting to get away from and very unsuccessfully at this point is bean counting. And so we have competing metrics. We have CMS. We have all these different things. There's overlap and there's confusion. And, you know, the whole purpose of this is to get community-based care in a wraparound sort of way. And the more bean counting we do, the less productive we are. So that's the reason for the question. So
yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Frankly, a little bit more of a comment than a question, but some clarification. First of all, a big shout out to the folks at OHA, Dr. Stock, Ms. Clement, Dr. Rickards, who I don't see in the room, and a bunch of other people who worked very, very hard to make this happen. A big shout out to the CCOs and the insurers who did this. Thanks to most of our federal delegation who wrote letters to the insurers to explain the importance of this. This was a huge team effort in a very short period of time. The point that I would make that's going to be really important is that in 2015, we passed Senate Bill 231, which talks about alternative payment methodologies for all practices. You'll notice that Dr. Stock said that FQHCs, rural clinics, and frankly, all of our pediatric practices, which are doing amazing wraparound services, are excluded from CPC Plus because they don't see Medicare patients or because they get cost-based reimbursement. It doesn't mean they don't need this. The committee out of 231 is really working hard to get there. With regard to Senator Cruz's comment, I couldn't agree more. And Senate Bill 440, from the 2015 session, requires standardization of metrics as much as possible across all commercial insurers and CCOs in Oregon. Obviously, there are going to be some differences depending on the kinds of patients that you have, but developing a standard set that you pick depending on your patient population will really go a long way, Senator, towards addressing those concerns. That work group, that task force or committee is just being finalized, and it'll be beginning at the beginning of this coming year in January or February. So we're making good progress in that regard. So I think these are important parts of the conversation here. And the experience from your practice is absolutely typical of what we've seen of CPC practices, which frankly makes me all the more disappointed that not all insurers and CCOs chose to participate this time around, because the data are overwhelmingly positive. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please, quickly.
Chair Monos Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Bob Gluckman. I serve as Chief Medical Officer for Providence Health Plans. Providence Health Plans is a strong proponent of patient-centered models of care and easing the way for patients as they navigate the health system to improve and sustain their health and well-being. We have a long history of participating in innovative payment models, our Medicare Advantage plan about 30 years, medical home model for PEB members are now expanded to multiple commercial populations for a decade, and then in our Medicaid plan as well, adopting many of the features that subsequently became part of the CCO model of care. However, we know that it's difficult for practices to implement the transformational changes required to deliver comprehensive services if there isn't multi-payer participation. Payment changes are necessary, as you've seen, to fund some of these other disciplines integrated into the primary care setting, like pharmacy and behavioral health. And practices need to be less dependent on fee-for-service visits and face-to-face contact and have the resources to provide care so that patients can get the care they need when they need it in whatever setting they need, which would include whether it's telehealth or phone or email, group visits, etc. We share the concern around the alignment of quality measures and think that part of the advantage of CPCI and CPC Plus has been to be able to have a more uniform set of measures. We are concerned about the uneven participation in the commercial marketplace for the success of CPC Plus. Dr. Stock noted 15 payers are currently participating in CPC Plus, but Providence Health Plan, we live in a very fragmented market in Oregon. There are multiple payers, or I think seven, that have 5% of the commercial market share or more. Out of those payers, Providence Health Plan is the only one to participate in both CPCI and CPC Plus. And that's created some challenges in the adoption of the model. So first, I'd just like to say, you know, when we look at CPCI, Oregon had the second highest number of Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries in the model. It had 53,000 Medicare beneficiaries. However, when you consider the total population that clinics serve, patients attributed by CMS to Providence Health Plan, Care Oregon, and the other payers, the total penetration of the practices that were selected only amounted to 26% of the patients served by the practices. By comparison, the penetration in Hudson Valley, New York, was 55%, and the penetration in Cincinnati was 53%, and the differences in penetration equate to real dollars and resources for primary care practices. The average CPC contribution in Hudson Valley was $58 per patient. In Cincinnati, it was $77 per patient. But in Oregon, the average payment across the payers for the practices was only $32 per patient. That lesser level of funding does equate into the amount of resources that can be put in for care transformation. And I will say that although the performance at Springfield Family Medicine was very impressive, our experience across the state was a little bit more uneven, and so that our experience at the health plan was that we about broke even from a resource perspective on what we put into the model versus what the savings were that were achieved. And we think that that's a big factor around that is that the practices need more resources if they're going to apply this model across all their patients, and that there should not be freeloaders. Right now, payers that are not participating are getting the benefits because part of the requirement of CPC Plus is that those resources have to be extrapolated or provided to all payers regardless of whether reimbursement is received or not.
Okay, just to that point, I'm trying to figure out which ones aren't here because that's nice of you to not, but I'm sure the committee would like to know why Kaiser, Cambia, Trillium, I think Legacy's in Trillium, why they are not participating. So I think we would love to have that information come to us
offline,
yeah. Not today.
Madam Chair, just a very simple question. I mean, because you're comparing Oregon and Pennsylvania and things like that, is because we are one of the lower federal reimbursement states, how much does, compared to some other regions, how much does that play into this? I mean, what the feds kick back to us for Medicare and Medicaid is much less than a lot of other states. So does that factor into this at all?
So I think that that factors into a portion of this, and it does factor into the fact that we have high commercial fee-for-service rates in Oregon compared to other parts of the country.
Right.
So I think there's a greater cost shift in Oregon. But I think that it's not just the I think that if the fee-for-service amounts were higher, that would not necessarily translate to care transformation, because then the only way practices would get revenue would be based on face-to-face visits. So I think one of the beauties of CPCI and CPC Plus, and the reason we participated in this, was that we felt that in order to get care transformation, we needed to get not only local payers to participate in a different reimbursement model and care and care redesign, but also to get the federal dollars to be brought into Oregon that would otherwise not be available. So I think that it's not just the fee-for-service amount. It's the fact that we can tie payment to a broader array of ways that we deliver care to people.
And we're a little over time, so can you sum up?
Yes, I will. Chair Moniz Anderson and members of the committee, good morning. I'm Mary Shemprud. I'm the Senior Business Leader of Alternative Payment Strategy and Contracting with CARE Oregon. CARE Oregon provides the Oregon Health Plan to approximately 250,000 Oregonians through our affiliation with the four CCOs, and we provide Medicare Advantage program to over 12,000 Oregonians as well. Most of them are dual eligible with both Medicare and Medicaid. We believe strongly that the CPC and the CPC Plus programs are a great example of how the CCO structure has helped support the very swift implementation of ideas to transform health care delivered in Oregon. And as we can see, the vast majority of the CCOs have agreed to participate in the CPC Plus program. Both of these, CPC and CPC Plus, have aligned with our work with the Healthcare Payment Learning Action Network, which is developing a national benchmark for the definition of alternative payment strategies. At this point, CARE Oregon has approximately 65% of their payments through an alternative payment methodology as defined by this group and CMS. The CPC APMs have been very beneficial to our operations, and so we have expanded those programs well beyond the demonstration population that CMS has in these programs. We include the federally qualified health centers, the rural health clinics, and the pediatric practices in our APM models. Because many of our members are served by these FQHCs and the pediatric practices, we didn't want to limit the benefit of these payment models to just those chosen by Medicare. And our APM model has reached more than 150 clinics throughout the state. CARE Oregon has worked long and hard on developing the APM models and have worked directly with the practices within the community and focusing on the clinical data and the operational priorities of the clinics themselves in helping develop the models. We've seen improvements in both clinical quality metrics from those reported through the electronic health records of the practices, as well as the data on the claims side. And we intend to replicate this experience in CPC Plus, we've also built it to include the integrated behavioral health services. We recognize and appreciate the work that's being done on the Senate Bill 231 and are very hopeful that the CPC Plus model will be able to help us wrap our arms around that and get the multi-payer collaborative going that we need to support the model and the transformation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I did make an error. Legacy's a part of Pacific Source now, correct? Yeah. Okay. All right. sort of. Things are changing. Yeah. Okay. All right. So thank you so much for this presentation. Sorry we had to rush through it, but very informative. With that, I'd like to go to the next topic, the Oregon Health Plan Open Card Coordination Program. John DePalma. Dr. Jeffrey McWilliams and Michael Wolf.
Good morning, Chairman Moniz Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Michael Wolf. I want to start by thanking you for the opportunity that you've given us today to come in and talk about the Open Card program and our efforts at KPRO. As you know, all very well aware, the Open Card program serves as a backstop for Oregon health plans, serves as a backstop for the Oregon health plan, and brings added value to the state's efforts to transform the healthcare system here. The program administered by KPRO complements the coordinated care model, ensuring that no OHP member falls out of coverage. Some people have asked us, is this a question of Open Card versus CCO? And we would say absolutely not. It is a partnership, and one that ensures that all Oregonians are receiving the right care, at the right time and in the right setting. And I would also note for the committee that KPRO's care coordination efforts have saved Oregon approximately $85 million in the last 6 years. No problem. So let me just spend a minute talking a little bit about KPRO. You may recognize You may be wondering who KEPRO is. KEPRO acquired, thank you very much, ma'am, acquired APS Healthcare, and that was finalized in May of 2015. Some of you may recognize APS Healthcare as the entity that was doing this work for the majority of those 6 years. KEPRO was founded in 1985 by the Pennsylvania Medical Society and has helped more than 20 million members live healthier lives. We're a national organization that's headquartered, as I referenced, in Pennsylvania, and we do work in 14 additional states in Medicaid, as well as the state of Oregon. One of the things that we think works best is we are very firmly committed to a local managed operation in the states we serve. Our Oregon office is located in Tualatin, with our caseworkers and care managers located around the state. And I'll turn it over to my colleagues to describe more about the program itself.
Chair Mona Anderson and members of the committee, my name is John DePalma. I've been the executive director at KEPRO since 2012. We began providing services in 2009 with a contract that was signed during that year. Most recently, we've signed a contract effective 7/1/2016 that is for 3 years and two 1 year extensions. So we currently service about 12% of the overall Medicaid population in the fee-for-service business, and we coordinate the medical, dental, and behavioral services across the board for those 125,000 members. In addition, in our most recent contract, we've expanded to provide some behavioral services that I'll talk about in just a second. On the next slide, page 5, we talk about what some of the characteristics are of our population. You can see that included in our population of 125,000, we do have dual eligible members, American Indian and Alaska Natives, medically fragile children, and many other combinations. But that's just to give you a flavor of some of what our population is. On page 6, we show you kind of the breakdown of the population. There's no real big surprises here. Most of the population that we manage is along the I-5 corridor, and we do have nurses throughout the entire state that can coordinate care both telephonically and face-to-face with those members. And obviously, we focus on the ones that have the highest acuity, which we call the highest acuity 4s and 5s in our ranking system. On page 7, we talk about some of the services that we provide. So our health coaches provide help to the members, both telephonically and in person. We do also provide a 24-hour nurse line so that all members can reach us at any time, and we can give them the right advice, whether that be to go to the emergency room or to seek care elsewhere. Our proprietary software is called Percolator. And that helps us identify who the sickest of the sick are based on the claims that we receive from the state. And soon we will roll out the pre-managed system, which is a census delivery system that provides us with real-time information on the admissions into the ER and into the hospitals. Our outreach will lead to a plan, an assessment done on each member, which ultimately leads to a plan of care that helps them with their medication reconciliation, their exercise, their diet, follow up on all of their appointments, and ensure that they're providing the highest level of care. I'm now going to turn it over to Jeff McWilliams, Dr. McWilliams, to talk a little bit about some of the strategies that we use to manage our clients.
Thank you, Chairman Mullins Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey McWilliams. I'm the medical director with KEPRO. Have been serving in that role since 2012. This slide is a slide demonstrating several of the strategies that we use to engage our members and achieve better outcomes. I'm not going to read it to you. I just wanted to point out a couple of things that we do aggressive medication reconciliation on patients who've been in the hospital and are discharged. We do that in the home, face-to-face with the members, because you are often surprised at what different medications the people are taking and don't realize that there's overlap. We also have an aggressive fall prevention program in place, and data would support that you can eliminate or divert approximately 50% of rehospitalizations just with fall prevention and in-home medication reconciliation, at least in the adult population. And then the other thing, I'm sorry, John was going to talk, and then I had something else, so I got ahead of myself.
Okay, I'll go to the next slide. Wanted to talk a little bit about outcomes and financial outcomes in particular. We also measure the same exact clinical outcomes that the CCOs measure, so we do have very good consistency there. However, from a financial standpoint, based on the actuarial agreement between the two organizations, this shows each year how much money we've been able to save in healthcare costs versus what OHA expected to spend, and you can see the trend is very positive into the sixth year at $24.7 million and over $85 million, as Michael had mentioned at the beginning, for the first 6 years of the program. We will be measuring year seven coming up here shortly and be able to report that in our annual report coming up in December. Back to you, Jeff.
Oh, so this is what I got ahead of. I wanted to talk to you a bit about a project that we're doing with treatment of patients with hepatitis C and direct-acting antivirals. The reason I want to share this with you is because I think it gives an example of some of the innovative strategies that we're doing at KEPRO, and it's a wonderful example of an interaction and collaboration that we have with the public sector, that being the Oregon Health Authority, private sector, us, and the academic sector. We are working closely along with the OHA and the Oregon State University College of Pharmacy to identify fee-for-service patients who have qualified for treatment of their hepatitis C with direct-acting antivirals. And we do case management for them, but we also get involved with them from the beginning with their pharmacy provider, with the prescribing physician or nurse practitioner. And we actually call and interact with these members every day to make sure they're taking their medication. As I'm sure you're well aware, this is very expensive treatment, somewhere on the order of $1,000 per day. And so our goal is to get the medications used properly if the people of Oregon are going to invest in this treatment. Some of the numbers, since we've been doing this, we've served 21 people. Nine of them have successfully completed their therapy. We've given, overseen more than 952 doses of medication. And the bottom line is highlighted and underlined, and that's that we've had a compliance rate of 99.5%. Most studies of medicine compliance in the United States at best will point to about 70% when patients are left on their own. And so we're proud of the innovative nature of this.
So the 952 doses, is that equate to each dose is $1,000 or?
Yes. It does.
And how many patients is that?
So the 952 doses would be 21? Across 21 patients.
21 patients. So 21 patients costs $952,000, but it's an excellent treatment. It works.
Yes, Senator. The other thing I wanted to point out is that our team is so engaged in this that we've out of those 21 members, we've actually found two members who had third-party liability insurance that should have been covering the meds and got them covered even retroactively. And with just a few phone calls, we're able to save $200,000 by being vigilant.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Are there...
I have a couple more comments, and then I'll wrap up. Behavioral health-wise, I wanted to just let you know that we started the behavioral health efforts on 7-1, mostly to support OHA and in the achievement of the U.S. DOJ objectives that have been laid out in their agreement. And we've added a psychiatrist to our staff, Dr. Young, and also hired several licensed mental health professionals to help us in that effort. But we've already engaged with the Oregon State Hospital and have a great agreement with them and a great consultative kind of a relationship built there. And I'll close by just saying the relationship with the CCOs also has been very positive, with warm handoffs of members that go back and forth between what we manage and what they manage. So we feel really good about that relationship. And on the very last page of the agreement, of the write-up, we do give you all of our names. So if you have any questions or anything to follow up on, you certainly can reach out to us. And we appreciate the time that you've given us today to share with you what we've been able to accomplish over the past 7 years in managing the fee-for-service population.
Senator Canote.
Thank you. When we met earlier this year, it was interesting to me to find out about kind of the rise in fee-for-service from what you guys are doing. So what do you attribute that to? Because, as you said, you work with the CCOs, and kind of the policy of the state is to try to move people into CCOs. So what would you attribute the increase in fee-for-service patients to?
So I, well, for sure, the Medicaid expansion. We were down to 42,000 members at one point in fee-for-service a couple of years ago. And then when that's when everything moved over to the CCOs, or a great majority. And then when Medicaid expansion came, our population grew to about 132,000. We're sitting at 125 today.
People getting good care, though. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much
for your time.
All right. With that, let's move on to the Women's Foundation of Oregon presentation. Emily Evans.
Debbie, get the report.
We're going old school analog here, and everybody has a paper copy, and we have executive summaries for the audience.
Okay. Yeah, great.
So what, let me first say thank you so much for the invitation and for letting us be here. Also, big thanks to Senator Steiner Hayward, who served on the advisory committee for this report and was really instrumental in its progress. So you all are about to
state your name for the
My name is Emily Evans, and I'm the executive director of the Women's Foundation of Oregon. You all are about to hold the first report on women and girls in Oregon that's comprehensive in almost 20 years. And you're among the first Oregonians and certainly the first policymakers to hold it, so I hope that feels exciting. if it's all right, I'd like to contextualize it a little bit for you and then go to the health and well-being section and walk through some of those top findings. So the last time... yeah, their names. The last time we had a comprehensive report was in 1998, and most of the data from that report was from the 1990 census. So if you can imagine where you were in 1990, I was in first grade, and the Berlin Wall had just come down, and nobody had a home computer. I imagine you all had maybe different haircuts then.
So I actually had hair then.
A different era. And it's been quite a long time. So we've been in a data blind about for half the state's population for nearly a generation, and that comes to an end today. So I'll start actually with a little bit of good news, if that's helpful. The first page gives us eight things to celebrate, eight ways that Oregon women and girls are really leading the way and making Oregon a great place to live. Everything from voting at higher rates, giving charitably and volunteering at higher rates, giving blood at higher rates, serving in public office at higher rates than most other states, comprising 70% of the public school teachers and 80% of the state's healthcare workers, minimal violent crime. You all will love this one. We have the highest rates of physical activity than women and girls in any other state. So take that, Colorado. And generally making Oregon a really great place to live. On the flip side, if you'll flip to the next page, you can see what we're calling the eight that can't wait. And together, these eight issues interconnect to make a system of daily challenges for Oregon's women and girls. I'll go through them quickly here, and then we can focus on the ones that are most relevant to this committee. The first is violence against women. An estimated 1 million women and girls in Oregon, over half the state's female population, have experienced some form of sexual or domestic violence. This is one of the highest rates in the nation. The next is systemic racism. We see poorer outcomes for women and girls of color in Oregon than we do for white women in Oregon and then for girls and women of color in most other states. So they're even worse than they are in the rest of the country, which is really very shameful.
Madam Chair, I understand that. Is there a difference between men and women in that category?
Here in Oregon? Yeah. It depends on the indicator. In some cases, like unemployment, men of color are doing worse. But in cases like poverty, women of color are doing worse. So it depends on the indicator. And we have that disaggregated in the data.
Okay. Thanks
for clarifying. The next is the cost of caregiving. Oregon is one of the least affordable states in the nation for child care, especially relative to our median income. We're the second least affordable for infant care and the fourth most least affordable for toddler care. The next are barriers to reproductive health. We have a strong history of protecting reproductive rights here in Oregon, but we have seen our unintended pregnancy rate stubbornly high over the course of the last 20 years. It's not much below 41% right now, so almost half the pregnancies in Oregon are unintended, which speaks to a systemic lack of access to information and care. And next, we have a wealth and wage gap. The wage gap in Oregon is roughly on trend with the wage gap in the rest of the country, but our wealth gap here is shocking. It's among the three highest in the nation, meaning that women in Oregon hold about 35 cents on the dollar, which is the sum total of a person's assets compared to men. The next is economic fragility. This is essentially a poverty number. We see almost a third of Oregon households being in an economically precarious situation, and most of them are headed by single-parent mothers. The second to last one that I know will be of interest to this committee is mental health. Oregon women and girls have the highest rates of reported depression in the country, the highest rates of heavy alcohol usage, much higher than average childhood trauma experiences, and a number of other poor mental health days per month. So together they combine to have some really shocking, worst in the country statistics for mental health here in Oregon. And the final is the public-private glass ceiling. We only have one CEO of a publicly traded company here in Oregon, and even though we have a lot of extraordinary women legislators, we have nowhere near representational leadership. And over half of the counties in the state don't have any women elected at the county commission level.
Madam Chair, just to back up a minute, I'm assuming that there's a pretty good correlation between the mental health issues and the single-parent households. Would that be a good assumption?
You know, I don't know that they're able to correlate the household reported, because it's two different data sets. But I love that you bring that point up, because as you can see in this infographic, our point is that these issues don't exist in isolation. They are all highly interconnected.
Right.
Economic fragility and the wealth and wage gap, the cost of caregiving, violence, all of them interconnect, and it's no surprise when you see us as worst in the country in many of these categories that they all function together as a system.
I kind of wanted to make that point. So.
Absolutely. So if you'll turn to the next page, it's always a little bit depressing when you get a big pile of data like this that I think is probably going to precipitate a reordering of ourselves and a reperception of ourselves here in Oregon. We think of ourselves as a really great place for women and girls to live, and the first hard look at the data in 20 years is telling us that that's not actually the case. And if you take nothing else from this report, take the knowledge that Oregon's women and girls are giving more but getting less than women and girls in most other states. The next page has a introductory letter, and it has five things that every Oregonian can do and five things that Oregon leaders can do. So I hope that that folks will take a chance to look at that. But before,
do you have someone that can monitor the computer so that they can keep up with what you're saying?
Thanks, Steve. That's the next page. Great. And this is all in the executive summary that everybody has. And then if it's all right, I'd like to go and direct your attention to a couple of key pages that I think will be of particular interest to the committee. If you'll go to the safety, trauma, and violence section, which is page 21, you'll see the adverse childhood experiences page. And we are among the top 10 to 12 worst states in the country for our rates of adverse childhood experiences. I know ACEs are much on the mind of the medical community right now, and our rates are really quite high. And we see the experience of that trauma really ripple throughout all of these life outcome areas, and particularly, to Senator Cruz's point, in the mental health area. There are many areas that sort of cross-pollinate with a lot of related things that I know are going to be important. But probably the most important chapter for this committee is the health and well-being chapter, which starts on page 55.
Just to point out adverse childhood experiences, I've been meeting with many families and actually in schools, and this is a huge area. More poverty is moving into my area, which is Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview. And the reports that we are hearing from teachers and from superintendents with poverty, with no affordable housing, so they're living in shelters, et cetera, it's really affecting our youth. So I just needed to make that as an offline comment.
No, it's a wonderful point, Madam Chair, and we see it it's as ground zero for poor life outcomes in health, mental health, economic situation, and many, many other areas. It's really quite distressing. So highly related to that, on page 55, you'll see social determinants of health. We've ordered the report such that many of these social determinants of health come right before the health and well-being chapter. We know how important so many of these things are. I know this is much on the committee's mind, and we wanted to frame that as the lens for this chapter. On page 56, you'll see the child and maternal health outcomes. At every point possible in the report, we've disaggregated by race and ethnicity where the data allow us to do so. And we have, in general, fairly good outcomes in terms of child and maternal health, except for when you disaggregate by race and ethnicity. And we see much poorer outcomes, especially in particular areas, for both low birth weight and infant death rates by race and ethnicity. The next couple of pages that I'd like to direct the committee's attention to are page 57 and 58, sort of seen together. These are the reproductive health sections. On the top of page 58, you'll see the unintended pregnancy rate that has been deeply stubborn over the past several years. It's gone down a little bit, but we still are just under 50% of our pregnancies that are unintended. And that doesn't surprise me that it correlates highly with what we heard on our listening tour. We went to 14 places all over the state and heard from 1,000 women and girls last spring, and 50% of them said that they'd faced some sort of obstacle to accessing reproductive health care, whether that means that they went on the second day of the month and their county clinic was already out of their Title X funds, or whether that means that in their middle school and high school there's absolutely no comprehensive sex ed to speak of whatsoever, despite whatever regulatory environment they're working in.
We did pass legislation that will provide access more readily access for reproductive prevention methods, and that could affect this, correct?
Yeah, I think so, and it'll be fascinating to watch that inflection point in the data. That's a great segue to the bottom of page 57 that is a graph, an infographic that shows that, in fact, the abortion rate has declined as reproductive information, access, and services here in Oregon have increased. So you see a number of inflection points there that are actually bringing the abortion rate down over the past several years. I want to be mindful of everybody's time. The last graph on that page is the STI infections over time. There's quite a substantive increase in chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis you'll see over the past several years, which will be no surprise, especially to folks at the county level. Probably worth noting in that space that many of those diseases actually wreak more serious consequences on women's bodies than they do on men's, and that's of particular gender concern in this space. The next page is the mental health care page. I'll ground this again in what we heard on tour. Over 70% of the women we spoke with said that they'd faced a mental health issue that had adversely affected their work, family, physical health, and or other relationships. It was really the sleeper issue that I didn't know that we would hear so loud and clear, that it's felt in communities the same way that we see it in the data. So you'll see there in that sort of grounding graphic on page 59, we are higher than average compared to the rest of the country for the two or more adverse childhood experiences, incidents of reported depression, and at least one poor day of mental health per month. And we aren't talking small numbers here. 33% of the state is 700,000 women. We heard again about how difficult it is to obtain services, mental health support and services, particularly in rural areas or for people who are low income. On page 60, we see sort of the many sort of both extreme and tragic outcomes that can come from untreated mental health issues, including the suicide attempts, which are much higher for women than for men in the U.S., the female incarceration rate, and you also see that the prisoners with severe mental health needs by gender is a massive difference by gender. Only 20% of men who are incarcerated have severe mental health needs, whereas 51% of women do. And the final page in this chapter is the physical health section. It has the leading causes of death on page 61 and the diabetes rates by race and ethnicity. But the thing that I found most interesting that I think this committee might be interested in is where we have better outcomes than most other states, physical activity, low rates of heart attack, obesity, diabetes, and stroke. On par with most other states is adult smoking rate, lung disease, prediabetes, cancer, heart disease. But the areas where we have worse outcomes than most other states is we have high rates of arthritis and asthma, as you know, and then also high rates of depression and heavy drinking in that mental health space. But if you look at the low screening rates on that page, we have low screening rates of mammogram, pap smear, cholesterol checks, and routine checkups, which speaks to me, at least, of a lack of preventative care in that space, sort of holistically with a gender-based perspective, particularly when you consider that our rates of uninsurance are lower than most other states. So this lack of preventative care was particularly interesting to us. The final thing that I'll point out before I take questions is that the back of the report, and in fact for each of you, what was pinned to the front of your report are our county level dashboards. They start on page, I think, 91, and we know I'm from Southern Oregon. I was born and raised in Ashland, and now I live in Portland, and I know just how easy it is when you look at state level data for everybody not in Portland to say, oh, those are Portland numbers, and for everybody who is in Portland to say, no, those are the rest of the state's numbers. So we've included what we understand to be the most robust local data on how women and girls are doing in each county that's ever been available. So the ones that were on the front of your report will be for the counties that your district touches, and it covers everything from the wage gap to the number of domestic violence calls, the life expectancy, the poverty rate, the local leadership rate, a whole gamut, everything we have basically at the local level. So I thank you so much for your time and attention. I think we have a few minutes for questions.
How was your funding for this project?
For this report? So we are a publicly supported, member-driven foundation. We're a CU3, and a group of 700-plus members came together to basically collectively fund this project. We also had companion funds from the United Way of Columbia Willamette, the Meyer Memorial Trust, and the Oregon Community Foundation.
Well, thank you so much for coming to Oregon Commission for Women, because that's where I first heard about it, and then coming to me and talking more about it. And then obviously you've talked with several other people too, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Evans, thank you, first of all, for your kind words. I've been honored to help with this. Second, you know, I personally wouldn't dispute a single word in here. Well, maybe a single word, but not very many of them, because I think they reflect the experience of women in Oregon that I see in my day-to-day life, and frankly, some of them that I've experienced myself. I guess my question for you is, can the Women's Foundation help us identify evidence-driven policies that will help us address some of these problems? Because it's all well and good to know what the problems are, but the reason for the legislature to know about this stuff is to have some ideas about what we can do to help. It can't be all the government. We have to have public-private partnerships on this, but we'd like to know what policies have been proven to work so we don't go about reinventing the wheel. Is that on your agenda for thinking about next?
It is. In fact, we have a companion report that will be released in the coming weeks that actually identifies 20 state-level policies that are evidence-based, not particularly heavy budget hits, and passed with strong bipartisan support in states that are doing better than Oregon is across many of these key indicators. And we'll have a rubric that says what we're missing here in Oregon and how existing statutes might be able to be tightened, as well as the evidence-based and the link to the original statute, everything from equal pay laws to paid parental leave to adverse childhood experiences, which is actually a public-private partnership in Washington State. Some key areas where other states are already making progress and we're already behind.
Could you send that to Sandy so she can get it to the rest of us?
Absolutely. We haven't actually released it publicly yet, but our intent is to do that this fall so that everybody's well prepared with them before the 2017 session.
It would be nice if we'd have a December informational hearing on it.
My hope.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful.
We would, you know, pre-session filing is Monday, but
yeah.
Yeah.
No, we have till December. So
we do.
Okay.
Pre-session speech. All right. One of the things that's worth noting about that companion report and this one is that we really don't have a prescriptive legislative agenda. Where the Women's Foundation is coming as a thought partner and a partner with many of the other great organizations that are doing work in this space, and we really are hoping to just bring information and help as much as we can, because we know how much you all care about women and girls in Oregon, and we'd like to help make a better state for women and girls.
Well, a statement to those stakeholders out here that focus on some of these issues that will be in the report that's coming out next month. It's important to hear from them also which ones they feel are doable and then can get behind them to see if we can do something in the 2017 legislation.
But, Madam Chair, the point is, I mean, pre-session filing is Monday. We still have unlimited filing until December. So,
yeah.
So if there's something we want to do based on the report,
right.
we can still do it.
Sure. Yeah, we just don't necessarily get it back for pre-session.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you all so much.
With that, I would like to start the next topic, childhood obesity, school and community solutions, Dr. Craig Gunderson, Dr. Kathy Gunter, and Pam Maria Neeson.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Gunter. I'm an associate professor at Oregon State University, and my area of expertise is related to physical activity as a mechanism for health, including obesity prevention. And I'm going to restrict my remarks to this domain. Dr. Craig Gunderson will follow with information on nutrition and food access policies for children as they relate to childhood obesity. So we appreciate the opportunity to provide evidence that will help you make decisions about effective strategies to combat childhood obesity. So I'll be sharing information about school-based obesity prevention approaches because the strength of the evidence is greatest supporting their effectiveness. The most recent published reports confirm that obesity is still very much a problem, and I'd like to draw your attention to the leftmost clustering of bars, which is the aggregate of male and female here, and the prevalence of obesity among elementary age children in the dark green color is about 17.5%, nearly double the prevalence among preschool age children in the lighter blue bars. There's a creep with obesity continuing to rise into adolescence, but notably, that gap between preschool and elementary age really indicates a need for early intervention. Now, Oregon does not have a surveillance system in place to collect obesity data statewide, but several recent studies in the past 5 years, the Grow Healthy Kids and Communities study, which is out of Oregon State University, and that's these data here, as well as the Healthy Growth study out of OHA and a group out of Oregon. The data are very consistent. They all looked at elementary age children across a variety of rural, non-rural, statewide representative samples. What you see here are over 2,000 children in 6 rural communities from 3 counties, Clackamas, Columbia, and Klamath. And at the far left, kindergartners, the orange is the proportion of children who are obese, all the way, the blue is overweight and the green is healthy weight. So between kindergarten and sixth grade, there's a more than doubling in the proportion of children who are obese. So it's clear that obesity is an issue for Oregon as it is for the rest of the United States. And while there are many potential factors that contribute to high obesity, the quality of children's diet and their ability to participate in physical activity is critical. So just as there are many contributing factors, there's also many approaches to combating obesity. But the evidence consistently supports that school-based physical activity approaches have the potential to influence the greatest number of children and have been demonstrated as most effective. And schools, as you can see on this graphic, provide a unique framework for the delivery of physical activity due to the opportunities to contact students multiple times via before school programs, regular school day programming, recess, PE, classroom physical activity breaks, and after school programming. Schools may also have greater capacity to sustain that programming and promote physical activity through that built-in network of teachers and peers, as well as through legislative actions such as PE standards and minimum recess time. So how much activity do kids need? Well, the federal guidelines, based on hundreds of primary research studies, recommend children get a minimum of 60 minutes a day that's predominantly moderate physical activity. And this is a minimum effective dose, including muscle strengthening and bone loading activity. When children are able to achieve this much physical activity, the evidence is strong that they're more likely to maintain a healthy weight, develop stronger bones, have a decreased risk of developing obesity and related conditions such as diabetes and heart disease. Evidence also shows that children who are regularly active have decreased depression and anxiety and better overall mental health outcomes. And more recently, a body of evidence is emerging that suggests children who are physically active perform better in school. And this is regular physical activity, so over the long haul, as well as short bouts during the school day. 5 to 10 minute bouts at school are associated with immediate benefits following those bouts, such as enhanced ability to pay attention, stay on task, and self-regulate classroom behavior. So at worst, physical activity does no harm. At best, there are tremendous positive benefits. So how active are Oregon children during the school day? This is the same data set that I just showed you. So these are those rural Oregon elementary schools. We measured physical activity from bell to bell during regular school hours. The pattern bars are the amount of total activity that children are doing from the time they enter the classroom to the time they leave during the regular 6.5 hour school day. And you can see that, and that's just any movement, getting up, moving about the classroom. So that's not that moderate intensity activity. The dark solid bars show the amount of health benefiting physical activity. So on average, kids are getting less than 20 minutes per day during a 6.5, 7 hour school day. And that's from all potential venues, recess, physical education, classroom-based physical activity. So, you know, the point here clearly is that no kids are doing enough physical activity, and that dose needs to be made up somewhere. And that's left to under-resourced families or, you know, other, in particular, have a challenge in trying to figure out ways to get that other 40 minutes of physical activity. So what are some of the most effective strategies? Well, we know that based on the available evidence, and these are listed in really a hierarchy in terms of the amount of physical activity that they tend to provide children, which then translates to these benefits. Optimize PE, and that's characterized by providing at least 150 and 225 minutes per week at the primary and secondary levels, respectively. Daily bouts of classroom-based physical activity, which enable children an opportunity to reduce the amount of sedentary time, gain more active minutes, refocus their brains. Daily recess, and in particular, structure and supervision in the context of that recess, which would enable even the most vulnerable children a safe space to be active. And then adding active transportation options, walk and bike to school programs where feasible, and after school programs that are inclusive of physical activity. And so you can see also listed are the challenges, and those challenges may vary by local municipalities and districts and motivation. But when they're implemented and supported, particularly by policies in place that enable them, they tend to provide physical activity that can be health promoting. So until recently, most Americans regarded weight healthy behaviors as a matter of personal choice. But as the number of obese children has tripled over the last 30 years, the evidence suggests that view is limited and potentially dangerous. Children, in particular, do not have volitional control over their environments. And as such, they have limited or no control to enact healthy physical activity and dietary behaviors. So if they're able to obtain that 60 minutes at school, unlike other programs, which are also effective, but if you provide the best school lunch, what happens outside of school, we don't know. They could be getting unhealthy food or insufficient food. But if they get their health-promoting dose of physical activity during the school day, it's done. That burden is off parents. Anything else is additive. So I want to just applaud Oregon in terms of being ahead of the curve with House Bill 3141 and say that only the District of Columbia has legislated PE standards to the best practice recommendations. So with Oregon and District of Columbia are alone at the pinnacle of progress in terms of these types of actions. And I'll turn over to Dr. Gunderson.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And thank you, to begin with, for the opportunity to present here. I also want to thank the Haley Ford Center for inviting me to be a part of this and the good people at Oregon State for allowing me to be a part of this. So I'm going to
Yourself first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Craig Gunderson. I saw on the slide. Sorry about that. Craig Gunderson, University of Illinois. I'm the Soybean Industry Endowed Professor in Agricultural Strategy in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics at University of Illinois. I want to present two quick slides to show what's critical to this issue. Is this gives the obesity rates by income in the United States amongst children. What you can see is on the far left side, those are children in households with incomes below the poverty line, with incomes less than approximately $25,000 for a family of four. All the way up to the right-hand side, where we have families with incomes above approximately $100,000 for a family of four, there's a sharp decline. One of the most effective anti-obesity strategies in the United States is to increase people's incomes, give people more resources. That's the first point I want to make on the first slide. Second slide is, I'm going to be talking a lot today about food insecurity, and it's going to have ties into a lot of what we talk about in terms of obesity. Similar story here. Those are the food insecurity rates. For children in households with incomes below the poverty line, food insecurity rates are about 40% or higher. As you get up to people with incomes above roughly $85,000 a year for a family of four, you have food insecurity rates that are quite small. Just like with obesity, giving people more resources to purchase food, similarly with food insecurity, giving people more resources to purchase food also reduces food insecurity. These are, in case you're interested, this is the food insecurity rates for Oregon for all households. We also have this at the child level. For those of you interested, you can go to Map the Meal Gap at Feeding America, which gives food insecurity rates for all counties in Oregon, in case you're interested. Now, turning to the topic of obesity prevention. The goal, everybody is talking a lot about this, and this is critically important, is how do we reduce childhood obesity in Oregon? Okay, I want to keep in mind, though, is that efforts to achieve reductions in childhood obesity do not hurt people over other dimensions, okay? In our efforts to reduce childhood obesity, we don't want to hurt individuals in Oregon, and in particular, we don't want to hurt poor children in these efforts to do this. Now, what I'm going to be talking about are some efforts that may hurt poor children over other dimensions, but first I want to say, interventions to improve physical activity. There's no downside to that. So this is not anything about what Kathy talked about. So the first thing that's been proposed by some in Oregon is soda taxes. Okay? Do they lead to reductions in soda consumption? Of course. Demand curves, I'm an economist, demand curves slope downward. You increase the price of soda, it's going to fall in consumption. No doubt about that. Will they generate increased revenues for Oregon? Of course. You're putting taxes on people, getting more money. It's a very regressive way to raise revenue in Oregon, but it is one way to raise revenue in Oregon. The question, though, is do they lead to improvements in health? What's our experience from looking at soda taxes around the country? Do they make children better off? There's really no evidence to point that they do over multiple dimensions. Do they lead to reductions in obesity? No. The answer has been consistently no, and this makes sense from many different perspectives, is when you tax soda, it becomes more expensive. People switch to other forms of sugary beverages in order to get those calories. So the evidence is pretty clear on this case is that there's no reductions in obesity. These two studies here did a systematic study of soda taxes that have been put in place across the United States to show that there's no reduction. Will they lead to increases in hunger in Oregon? Yes, absolutely. It's by imposing soda taxes, what ends up happening is it drives up the price of food, which means low-income households then face more difficulties in affording enough food. So soda taxes as a policy is they will lead to reductions in soda, they will increase revenue for Oregon, over those two dimensions are great, no impact on obesity, and will lead to increases in hunger. So that's the first thing I want to consider. The second thing I want to talk a little bit about is SNAP. And I'm going to skip through all of this. SNAP is an Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as the Food Stamp Program, is an amazing program insofar as it sets out with the goal of alleviating hunger, and it does that. It's a great government program with respect to this. And I want to praise Oregon, since I don't very often have, well, Oregon's a great state, but also be able to say it here, is that given that the gross income threshold in Oregon is higher, you all have made some great strides to making sure that more Oregonians can, can then have more of this. So is that that's fantastic that more and more people living here can have.
Madam Chair, while we're there, it's an issue I've had for a while when I go into a convenience store and see people using SNAP to buy potato chips, for example. I've often questioned whether it might make sense to put the same standards on SNAP as we have on TANF.
Go ahead, sir. I apologize. I'm just so grumpy about this issue.
So, Senator Anderson, may I respond?
Yes, please.
Okay. So, if you look at the in terms of your specific issue regarding purchases of these things, if you look at the purchases made by SNAP recipients, is they mirror the rest of the population? Is they eat some good things and they tend to eat bad things like I do and so like others. So in other words, we don't see much difference in terms of what you do. In terms of your second point regarding possible TANF has restrictions on work and things like that, if that's what you're talking about, is the design of SNAP is dramatically different than the design of TANF. It's designed as an anti-hunger program rather than a work encouragement program. And I want to say one other thing from an economic perspective, why SNAP is particularly effective. One of the problems with TANF was you had these quote-unquote cliff effects. If you make a dollar more, you lose all your benefits. It's discouraged work. SNAP does not discourage work by the structure of the program, because for each additional dollar you earn, you lose 30 cents in benefits. So it's really a work-encouraging program because, I mean, there's a tax on people, but it doesn't have those cliff effects.
Madam Chair, I know the difference between the programs. What I'm talking about is maybe potato chips shouldn't be some. I mean, if this is the nutrition program and we're dealing with an obesity issue, that maybe it taking a look at what's consumable in that program may be a valuable thing to even take a look at.
Madam Chair, I'm going to actually be two slides from now. I'm going to present on just this exact topic.
Okay.
If that's fine. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt anybody else.
No, it's good.
Go ahead, and then I know Senator Steiner Hayward wants to say something.
Okay.
So the
first thing I want to point out is there's a perception among some that SNAP recipients, that SNAP leads to obesity. That's false. Is that all the evidence shows that either SNAP has no impact on obesity, in other words, in comparison to eligible non-participants, either SNAP participants are no more likely to be obese, and there's some evidence that actually SNAP recipients are less likely to be obese than eligible non. So it's an anti-obesity program. SNAP does a great job, along with being a great anti-hunger program. And the recent evidence actually shows that those who get more SNAP benefits are even less likely to be obesity. So if you want to make obesity fall in Oregon, there's some evidence to show that give people this. It's the same thing that I pointed out before. You give people more money to purchase more food, they have better choices. That's why, you know, you see the lower rates of obesity amongst higher income households. Now, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, I want to talk a little bit about restrictions on SNAP purchases, of what we know about this. Is that actually there's some evidence that if we impose restrictions on SNAP along the lines that some have proposed, is that this may actually lead to increases in obesity because fewer children would benefit from the program for the reasons I'm going to come to now. We know, though, for sure that if we impose restrictions on SNAP, there'll be more hungry children in Oregon for the main reasons of they're less likely to participate in the program because it's more stigmatizing once you impose restrictions, and there's also really high transaction costs. I've spoken with the Grocery Manufacturers Association and Walmart, I should say a large food corporation, about some of these issues, and they've given me indications about how much it raised food prices, and in particular for SNAP recipients for various other reasons, and it would increase food prices. So proposing restrictions on SNAP would probably have no impact on obesity, may actually increase obesity, and it will lead to increases in hunger. And this is why the consensus has been raised that it would not be an effective way to deal with obesity. Now, if we want to impose restrictions for other reasons, that may be fine. But in terms of reducing obesity or improving health, there's no evidence that that would improve it. But I want to end on a positive note. So what are some better approaches to SNAP and obesity? The first one is there's some proposals to resist, to have block granting of the program. While there are some advantages to block granting of SNAP, one of the main disadvantages is SNAP does a great job of increasing, if you saw in Oregon during the recent recession, is you saw an increase in the number of SNAP participants. That's great for grocers, grocery stores, and people employed in grocery stores all across Oregon. The SNAP was flexible. Block granting eliminates that possibility. Second thing is increased participation rates. While many, many children in Oregon are participating, and that's fantastic, and Oregon, again, should be commended. You have one of the highest participation rates amongst eligibles in the United States. Fantastic. That's given the success of this program. Plus, most importantly, it's bringing a lot of federal dollars in. I mean, you're bringing a lot of federal dollars in if you get more people on SNAP. Every loaf's federal dollars. So, well, I don't know. I can't speak for all of you. Maybe perspectives are different here than in Illinois. Well, I'm sure they're different than Illinois, but we're many dimensions. And let's hope they're different here than Illinois. But that's neither here nor there. The final thing is that there's evidence that if we want to reduce obesity and improve the well-being of children, is there's some there's a lot of evidence that higher benefit levels would help out a lot. And there's things that can be done over all three of these dimensions, albeit only limited. The second one is something Oregon in particular. So I wanted to thank you again, Madam Chair, and all the other senators so much.
Pam, very quickly, please.
Okay, very quickly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pam Marianason. I'm the executive with Providence Health and Services for the Oregon region. Thanks for the chance to speak today. I got to say, this is probably not terribly professional of me, but I had this whole set of remarks, and my heart's heavy just listening to all of this. So I'm taking some strength from what Senator Dr. Steiner Hayward just said, which is, you know, we don't want to just study problems. We want to understand them, but then we need to move on to what are best practices. And my brief comments are about the intersection of the health system and the community and where we can understand what those best practices are. We need to understand where we can work better together between the health system and the community to lift these kids up out of poverty. One of the things that Providence, we did this past year, was really look at some of these major public health crises and determine where, based on our own community health needs assessment, we needed to invest our community benefit dollars. Where were those areas that we found most compelling? And we've been studying ACEs, and we've been looking at kids, and we know now that this generation of the kids, based on some latest work out of Robert Wood Johnson, might be the first generation to have shorter lifespans than we did. So it's hard to imagine that, but that's the fact. And as we've studied, what can we do about that? You've heard from my colleagues today some of the best practices that we are aware of, which are obviously the adequate physical activity, the two hallmarks, the adequate physical activity on a daily basis and that nutrition piece that we're hoping to be able to partner with our communities. And so we are putting grants out into the community through our community benefit dollars to work with partners. Where we get really excited is where the school districts are engaged and involved in that work in each of our communities. We have 8 hospitals, as you know, and over 40 clinics. And where we can partner, we want to partner. And we're challenging ourselves on the clinical side, too, to look at this problem differently than we have, because there are these issues around ACEs, there are these issues around mental health, there are a lot of issues, and particularly for the areas that we study in our community health needs assessment around disparities. And when you look at, I just brought a couple of quick statistics, but when you compare kids in the eighth grade, our Caucasian kids at a little less than 10% obesity rate, and our Latino population at just about 15% in the eighth grade, by the time we get them into the 11th grade, you know, the Caucasian population has gone up to almost 12%, and our Latino population has gone up to 17.5%. And so, I mean, I can talk to you about other disparities, but we know it's an issue of disparity. We know it's an issue of income. We know it's an issue of need. We know that there's mental health issues in the family. Families, there's ACEs, there's all these things swirling, and I think that's where my not-so-professional, oh, my gosh, what do we do? But we do know some best practices, and these my colleagues here just outlined them. So that's what we're attacking as best we can across Oregon. We want to work with you to do that. We want to work with the school districts to do that. We welcome energy from the legislature around continued exercise and activity in the schools. We welcome continued activity around food support, and we're trying to do the best we can to partner. So thank you for your chance to
And very
present.
Quickly.
Two very fast comments.
I would remind everybody that the state is not allowed to set rules about what people can buy with SNAP benefits.
No.
So no matter how much we protest about it, mm-hmm. I think we do need to remember that it's a very important benefit that the vast majority of people use in very, very thoughtful ways to feed their families. And it is a really important program. The second point I would make is we have to understand this issue in the context of so many other things. We care about our graduation rate in the state. We should care about physical activity. The data are crystal clear that increasing physical activity improves school performance, and that improving health improves school performance. So for all these reasons, we cannot look at this issue in a vacuum. The Health Committee should care about this about education as an education issue, too. Thank you, Madam Chair. I
Thank
appreciate
you so
your
much for coming. Thank you so much for coming from Illinois. That's where my grandkids live. So, all right.
Hey, thank you.
With that, I'd like to have an update just very briefly from the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board, because I heard Susan King is here, correct? Okay, so we'll go back to the original schedule, Susan King and Carol Bradley.
Good morning, Senator Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. And with my partner, Carol Bradley, I co-chair the newly established Staffing Advisory Board to the Oregon Health Authority. We understand your instructions to be brief, so we will. I just want to say that I think this update of the staffing law, which was first passed in 2001 with the help of Senator Canope, has been a great opportunity for us to work with our partner hospitals to achieve better hospital staffing, nurse staffing. We know the data is clear, has been presented to you many times about the linkage between the quality and safety of care and the adequacy of nurse staffing. That was the data that supported the first law and certainly has carried us through 2015. You have before you either the full report or the executive summary of our report. I won't go through that. It does give you a history of the work that has been done both in the 2015 legislature and then with the establishment of the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board, the rulemaking process that occurred beginning in January of 2016. The Nurse Staffing Advisory Board, established by the 2015 statutory changes, actually began its work acting as the rule advisory because the rulemaking process had timelines attached to it, and so our very first piece of work was to advise the Oregon Health Authority on the administrative rules which will actually implement the 2015 changes and all of the rest of the staffing law. I will be happy at the end if you have questions about the report to answer those, but didn't intend to go through them for you since you have the report. I would like to turn the microphone over to Carol Bradley to talk about some of the outcomes and just to flag for you some concerns that we have going forward that we hope to resolve by the time we talk to you next.
Good morning. I am honored to be here, and I'd like to introduce myself first. In addition to my role on the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board, I also serve as the Chief Nursing Officer at Legacy.
State your name, though.
I'm sorry, Carol Bradley. I work as a Senior Vice President and Chief Nursing Officer at Legacy Health in the Portland area. I've been honored to serve with Susan on the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board. My goal today is simply to follow on to Susan's comments, tell you a little bit about our experience this year. We've had a very dedicated group of nurse leaders and staff who have participated in this work all year. I think they ended up committing a lot more time than they probably signed up for in that we met 11 times, and I think the outcome of this year was very productive, and I want to highlight the fact that I think the Oregon Nurses Association and the Hospital Association worked together collaboratively to find common ground on almost every issue in this law, and I think that is symbolic of the partnership that we feel is necessary to ensure that we have really reached the goal of improving patient safety, which was obviously the mission of this law. There are two areas that I think continue to be areas of concern for both the Hospital Association and the Oregon Nurses Association. The first is more of a process issue in that in the law, in the rules, you will find that an exception was made for the Oregon State Hospital. From the perspective of the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board, we were concerned about the lack of transparency and the process that was involved in getting this language into our rules without the involvement of the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board. The second issue we have with the language that applies specifically to the Oregon State Hospital is that it just applies to the Oregon State Hospital, and that we feel that our evidence-based standards around how we staff and what the exceptions might be to any staffing regulation, that we would apply evidence-based rules or goals for all hospitals, and that we wouldn't set aside and make an exemption for a hospital outside of the guidelines that we've tried to establish collaboratively. The second remaining issue is something that, ironically, the Hospital Association and the Oregon Nurses Association have come to agreement on, which is how we manage overtime, both a regular overtime and mandatory overtime, and how that impacts the work-life balance of nurses, yet balances the safety of patient care. And that is a fine balance of ensuring that we are both ensuring a workable schedule for nurses, yet also limiting hours and ensuring that we are honoring the data and research around fatigue and making sure that nurses are not working hours beyond what is safe for patient care. We have had difficulty, I think, educating and translating this language that we've developed around overtime to the Oregon Health Authority. And I think this this law represents a learning curve for them. We appreciate that. But we're also concerned about the fact that we are much more involved on the day-to-day staffing of nurses in our hospitals today. And we are concerned about the way the overtime law is being interpreted and how it may, in fact, impact how we can schedule nurses. I've been impacted today sitting and listening to all of the reports you've received about care transformation and the various strategies that are underway. And there was a common theme in them that really hit home to me, and that is they're all nurse dependent, meaning that we have a tremendous amount of healthcare transformation going on in this state, and it's very nurse dependent. To me, that means that we have to protect that asset and ensure that in our hospitals today that we have a viable way of staffing and utilizing the expertise of nurses within our hospitals today. The overtime regulation that we're still trying to resolve from a rules writing standpoint is something that hospitals depend on to ensure that we have nurses available, the expert nurses available, really 24/7. In closing, I would just like to say it's been an honor to be part of this process. I think the relationship that the Hospital Association has developed with the Oregon Nurses Association will help ensure that patients are safely cared for, yet nurses are appropriately being utilized and have the opportunity to have work-life balance in terms of their commitments to health care in the state of Oregon. And I'm happy to Susan and I both are happy to answer any questions.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah. First off, you know, I find it interesting that if the nurses and the hospitals have agreed on something relative to overtime, that I would think that would be what the rule would reflect. And I'm hoping that we do get to that point, Lynn. I would also suggest that carving out the state hospital, which has probably more need than any other hospital we have just because of who's there, absolutely makes no sense either. So I'm with you on both those issues and hope we get them resolved appropriately. The one question I would have, and I'd like some real information from you all, because we aren't talking about nursing shortages at this point, and we know we still have shortages, and you talked about as we're moving forward. So it'd be kind of nice to have some kind of dig in the weeds on that, find out where the shortages are, and kind of ideas as how we address that, because it's something that's not going away on its own. So,
Senator Manus Anderson and Senator Cruz, those were a lot of questions.
Yes.
I'd like to offer two responses on the issue of the interpretation of the overtime mandatory and other types of overtime. We are working very hard outside of this legislative body with our partners, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, to try to resolve this unfortunate interpretation outside of coming back to you, because we know you have major issues to contend with in 2017, and so we are still hopeful to come to resolution. If we're unable to, because of the nature of the issue, which is really what is the period of break between the end of a long shift and the beginning of another shift, that is really one of the core issues, then we might have to come back for what we would hope is a small fix. But I can assure you on behalf of ONA, and I'm sure Carol will as well, that we're doing everything that we can not to bring it back to you to fix that problem. On the issue of the shortage, perhaps we could leave that for another day, because there are certainly issues that we can address with nursing workforce. And Senator Cruz, you've certainly been a part of that for years, so we'd be happy to talk more
about
it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I wasn't asking. I would just, it needs to still be on the radar.
Got it.
That's my point.
It certainly is.
Okay.
And we would agree with that. Most
thank you so very much.
Thanks.
All right. With that, I'd like to move on to the Task Force on School Nursing Recommendations. We have a video that we'd like to start off with, and from Nina Fakaris, and then Mitch Kruska and Margo Lalik, please. Will we start with that, or are you going to start?
Yeah.
And I had the honor of serving on this task force, and
all the problems should be solved.
So, but we had a really dedicated, very knowledgeable group of people there, along with staff from OHA.
Thank you for recognizing that, Senator.
And hopefully, hold it, before we actually start it, will she say her name at the very beginning? If not, could you say her name?
I will introduce. Yeah. This is Nina Fakaris. She is a full-time school nurse of about 30 years for the Beaverton School District. She was chair of the Task Force in School Nursing, and she also is president-elect of the National Association for School Nurses.
Yeah. Anderson, committee members. My name is Nina Fakaris. I'm a school nurse and chairman of the School Nurse Task Force. I'm sorry I can't be with you today, but because of technology, I'm glad I'm able to share with you by video, and I'd like to share a few of my thoughts. Oregon schools are in crisis. The basic health and medical management needs of our students with chronic and acute conditions are not being met due to the severe shortage of school nurses across the state. Since the school nurse legislation passed in 2009, the number of school nurses has not increased. In fact, it's decreased. The task force report will show that almost 30,000 students do not have any access to a school nurse. But really, it's the medical complexity of students attending our schools that has dramatically increased over the last 7 years. Our school nurses that serve our rural population with large geographic areas have asked us this year, how can they safely delegate a homemade tube feeding that's too thick to be fed via gravity? Is it safe to have a teacher's aide do a plunge feeding? How much pressure on the syringe is safe? Is there any medical evidence that shows that the school nurse can use to develop an emergency care plan? And what needs to accompany that care plan? And every day we ask our building secretaries to stop what they're doing around lunchtime when the office is the busiest with parent calls, teacher requests, daily medications, to stop and calculate an insulin dose based on the amount of carbohydrates and blood sugar, draw up that dose, and administer that insulin. When in the hospital, it takes two registered nurses to do the same procedure. Yet we ask school staff across the state to do this every day without a nurse even being in the building. Oregon school nurses cannot safely plan and supervise the amount of staff needed to provide the basic emergency health care for students with chronic and acute illnesses, let alone provide the primary public health education and care coordination that can impact absentee rates and address health and mental health concerns like school nurses across the nation do every day. The legislature must act this session to provide immediate relief to school districts to help fund school nursing positions. Two of my colleagues from the task force will present to you the findings and recommendations. If you have any questions, you can address them or please email me. My address can be found in the report. Thank you for helping nurses keep Oregon students healthy, safe, and ready to learn.
So my name is Margot Lalage, Senator Mona Sanderson, and members of the committee. I was the vice chair for the task force in school nursing, and on a daily basis, I'm the director of school health services for Multnomah Education Service District. So Senate Bill 698 was passed in the last legislative session, and it created the task force in school nursing, as well as the role of the state school nurse consultant that's housed at the Oregon Health Authority. There were four goals that were assigned to this task force, and that is to examine healthcare funding streams, recommend new funding streams, recommend standards for school nursing practice, and recommend ways to create a coordinated school health services delivery model. The task force held its first meeting in March and has met monthly since then. The task force held its last meeting in September to approve the report that's before you now. To provide you with a basic understanding of the topic in question, I would like to share the definition of school nursing. It's a specialized practice of public health nursing. It protects and promotes student health, facilitates normal development, and advances academic success. School nurses grounded in ethical and evidence-based practice are the leaders that bridge healthcare and education, provide care coordination, advocate for quality student-centered care, and collaborate to design systems that allow individuals and communities to develop their full potential. Much of what has already been discussed this morning in previous presentations. The role has changed significantly over the years with increased chronic disease, increased mental health needs, increased specialized health care needs, and the improvement of medical technology that has allowed more children to attend school. The myth of being Band-Aids and bloody noses has become obsolete. There are 79 of the 197 districts in Oregon that do not provide any school nursing services. This equates to about 30,000 students. There has been no increase in the number of nurses since the last task force report in 2008. It is against the law for anyone other than a nurse, a registered nurse, to delegate care for students at school. And there's an immediate need to increase the number of school nurses in Oregon. This is a map of Oregon divided by school districts. It's very important to note that much of the map is white, and those are areas where there are no school nurses. Again, that's about 30,000 students. The dark red is one school nurse who serves 4,500 students. That's 4,500 students. And there are about five districts that meet the recommended ratio of 1 to 750. The 2016 data shows approximately 262 registered nurses in Oregon schools, 43 of which work as 1-to-1 nurses, with a student who requires daily
direct, and continuous professional nursing services. There are multiple situations throughout the school year in which we don't have an adequate number of nurses or trained school nurses to care for students. And those students are not allowed to attend school because they don't have the required supports they need. This is a direct violation of FAPE, which is the Free and Appropriate Access to Public Education. One of the reasons the school nursing situation in Oregon has become a crisis is the increase in chronic health conditions and the need to provide safe and accessible learning environment for all students. The data listed in Oregon is Oregon's first attempt at participating in a national data set collection through the National Association of School Nurses and the National Association of State School Nurse Consultants. This is based on a survey results representing close to 400,000 students. As you can see, type 1 diabetes is the biggest challenge facing school nurses and school staff in Oregon, and that continues to increase. Based on a spring survey with district business managers, the task force learned that 81% of districts use general fund monies to provide nursing services, 22% participating in MAC, which is Medicaid Administrative Claiming, and 10% reported billing Medicaid for direct services, most typically nursing, speech, and transportation. Nurses can have a significant impact on educational outcomes when adequately staffed. Health is identified within the recent Every Student Succeeds Act as an essential component of education. Research also shows that the positive impact that a school nurse can have on districts includes attendance, and we know in our own agency we serve over 100,000 students, more than 80% are returned to class after seeing the school nurse. The cost benefit, $2.20 is saved for every dollar invested, and the time savings, 1 hour for the principal, 20 minutes for the teacher, and more than 45 minutes for clerical staff. You heard last legislative session from a number of classified staff who are extremely concerned about student safety and the care that they are either being asked or told to deliver in the school setting. This is also of grave concern to districts as well as the nurses. These can include tube feedings, urinary catheterization, insulin injections. It doesn't include having to be trained to administer emergency medications, respond in an emergency with one of their many students, including epinephrine, glucagon, or an adrenal crisis. The choice to delegate falls to the registered nurse. Because of the staffing crisis in Oregon schools, most school nurses feel no choice but to delegate. It's also important to note that nurses function autonomously, practice autonomously under their licensure. Therefore, I cannot, as a director of a program, nor a principal, nor a superintendent, tell a nurse to delegate. If the nurse does not deem that it is safe to delegate, it may mean that a student cannot attend school. Additional questions have been raised this school year include IV administration of medications in the school setting, providing feedings by way of a nasogastric tube, administration of essential oils, oxygen administration, safety in the school setting. We've even had conversations around DNR in the school setting. Our listserv, since the beginning of September, includes many questions around, do you have a policy or a procedure related to this? We've never seen this before. Does anyone know how to do this in the school setting? Some school districts in Oregon are taking advantage of the option to bill Medicaid, both MAC and direct billing. What the task force found, though, is that this is a source of funding to supplement school nursing that is not being leveraged. Two examples, there's one school district that intentionally decided to take all of its revenue and reallocate it to its delivery of school health services, comprehensive school health services, and found a significant benefit to that. One example for us at Multnomah ESD is that we have four schools dedicated to very involved students, very high-risk populations, many who have complex medical needs. We take all of our MAC dollars, and it provides a full-time school nurse or a nurse in that particular setting.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is such an important point. I have long been baffled
about why school nurses come out of an education budget rather than a health budget. Mm-hmm. And I'm delighted that you're bringing up this point, and I hope every school district is listening to this and takes full advantage of this. This is a health issue, and it gets back exactly to my comment about the other presentation. You cannot separate health from education, and yet we're paying for health with education dollars, which would be fine if there were sufficient education dollars, but there aren't. And this is a function that should be a community-supported medical issue, a health issue. So thank you for emphasizing this point, and I hope more and more districts understand the value of this.
Thank you.
It just infuriates me.
Well, to continue on that topic, private insurance, CCOs, and fee-for-service billing infrastructure would be a huge challenge for education in the short term. Community benefit funds should continue to be explored, as well as alternative sources of funding, such as medical marijuana, a potential sugar-sweetened beverage tax, or tobacco taxes. While some task force members feel that these present as possibilities in the long term, the current staffing crisis necessitates a more immediate fix.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Mitch Kruska. I am Director of Educational Programs, Secondary Transition and Alternate Assessment with the Oregon Department of Education. One of the many areas that I oversee is the specialist at the Oregon Department of Education who deals directly with school health and school nursing. One of the supports that we provide to school nurses are the training for new nurses every year that we do with our OHA partners. And then we also maintain the school nursing listserv, which is Margo referred to. Nurses can go on there and connect with each other to ask questions or raise issues that they have to get advice from other nurses. My role this morning is to go ahead and share with you the recommendations that were actually agreed to by the task force. And there are three of those. The first is immediate and sustained funding for underserved school districts. As Margo mentioned, many districts currently have no access to school nurse services or do not meet the required medically fragile, medically complex nursing dependent student to school nurse ratio set forth in law. The immediate funding would be directed to ODE, who would use the funding to assist underserved school districts to immediately fund school nursing positions while creating a sustainability plan with each school district. The second recommendation is immediate and sustained funding to implement and maximize school-based Medicaid billing process throughout the state. Allocate general fund revenue to affect the immediate funding of school nursing positions and to support the creation of a state infrastructure and staff to support increased school district Medicaid billing. Implementing this change will require amendment of the state Medicaid plan to ensure services can be reimbursed. It is the task force's recommendation this occur as quickly as possible. And the third recommendation is a mandated and financially supported Oregon Department of Education and Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division interagency work group. This work group would have the mandate to develop statewide school nursing standards of practice and to create an integrated school health services delivery model. At this time, we would be open to any questions that the committee may have.
Questions. We're going to go forth and propose legislation to, so I will say that. And if there is no further questions from the committee,
thank you
so very much. All right. With that, we'll move on to an update on CCO Oregon activities, Sarah Love and Ben Hoyne. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. For the record, my name is Sarah Love. I'm the policy director at CCO Oregon. We're here just to provide a little bit of background about our organization and give updates about the work that we've accomplished in 2015 and how that has been incorporated through a variety of programs in Oregon. CCO Oregon is a nonprofit member association that aims to be shaped by and to serve all stakeholders that touch coordinated care in Oregon. Our purpose is to support the delivery of exceptional care at reduced cost while promoting the health and well-being of Oregonians. CCO Oregon focuses on three core areas: collaborations and connections, research, analysts and reporting, and policy exploration.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ben Hoyne, Executive Director of CC Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity to present today. As Sarah mentioned, we are a membership organization. We're a network comprised of healthcare leaders, coordinated care stakeholders. Our membership right now, which you have a roster of, includes the majority of CCOs, the four major dental care organizations, health plans, hospital systems, provider associations, federally qualified health centers, technology corporations, and many more. The organization structure of CC Oregon is linear, with a board of directors on top, working with a policy committee at the center that's comprised of our various work group chairs, which Dr. Love will get into here more momentarily, and key CCO stakeholders. That group oversees the work groups and the direction, providing feedback for the work group products. The foundation of CC Oregon is the variety of work groups that we have. They focus on specific topics related to coordinated care. They complete a variety of products, which may include position statements, voluntary agreements, suggested standards of care, and support for rules and regulations. The policy committee and the board of directors are charged with approving work group products. Approval process for work group products at CC Oregon falls to the policy committee and then further the board of directors in order to meet the thorough and transparent standards of consensus agreement at CC Oregon.
So just to give you a little bit of background of the work groups, we have five different work groups currently: our dental work group, our behavioral health work group, which is named the Integrative Behavioral Health Alliance of Oregon, or was it abbreviated IBEHAL, pharmacy, social determinants of health, and state and federal regulatory affairs. The policy committee and the board of directors do have limitations of being CCO Oregon members only, but we don't have this as a requirement for the work groups. We strive to be inclusive and allow for a limited number of key stakeholders to have opportunities to participate on our work groups without a financial obligation. This policy is allowed from participations from nearly all the CCOs throughout 2016. Today I'm going to highlight completed works again from two of the work groups, specifically dental and behavioral health. As I mentioned earlier, our behavioral health work group is called IBEHAL. This was formed 2 years ago in June of 2014 by primary care behavioral health integration experts from around the state. They include behavioral health providers, primary care providers, and representatives from health plans and health systems. This collaborative format of IBEHAL allows clinicians and leaders to thoughtfully discuss and promote the practice of primary care behavioral health and has allowed their organizations to thoughtfully integrate many of the recommendations into their primary care practices, standardizing workflows and creating best practices that can be replicated throughout the state. IBEHAL fosters this collaboration of comprehensive evidence-based discussions. These discussions led to the creation of the recommended minimum standards for patient-centered primary care homes, or PCPCH, providing integrated health care, and this should have been provided to you via OLIS. This body of work was the result of 8 months process utilizing healthcare resources such as the Agency for Healthcare Quality, Research and Quality, Behavioral Health, and Primary Care Integration, and other research evaluating staffing models and ratios for behavioral health integration and primary care. In addition to numerous organizations utilizing this framework when working within their clinics, this work has been cited and incorporated into the 2017 PCPCH Technical Specifications and Reporting Guide as a best practice note. It is also a resource on the Patient-Centered Primary Care Institute webpage. IBEHAL is also named on the Transformation Center webpage listing current activities and behavioral health integration. Moving on to our dental work group, that is composed of many different CCOs and DCOs who convened with the goal of reducing administrative burden. The project throughout 2015 was to create a uniform set of oral health metrics that CCOs and DCOs could use in their service level agreements for simplification in measuring oral health. The threshold for including metrics into this was that it had to be both relevant and feasible to measure for both DCOs and CCOs. Then deliberation revolved around the alignment within CCO incentive measures and specifically populations such as pregnant women and patients with diabetes. The objective was to promote CCOs and DCOs to work together and incorporate these metrics that align also with CCO community health improvement plans, but also offering CCOs flexibility to include metrics that will complement their current work within their local communities.
The final product, which you have available to you as well, is this bank of metrics, which is two sets of metrics, including a quality core measure set and an a la carte measure set. The core measure set are metrics that the workgroup considered foundational for measuring oral health in a variety of domains, including utilization, preventative services, access to care, and patient experience. The a la carte metrics are designed to further health transformation. Emphasis was placed on adult oral dental metrics, such as measuring periodontal evaluations in patients with diabetes. This particular measure also has the added benefit of encouraging coordination between CCOs and DCOs and providing pertinent information to ensure that adults with diabetes receive clinically appropriate oral health evaluations. The dental work group also wished to emphasize the use of the Emergency Department Information Exchange, or ED, when they're looking at emergency department utilization and timely follow-up. These measurement sets were intended for use as voluntary agreements to be incorporated when appropriate in the service level agreements between the DCOs and CCOs. However, since it has been approved, we've been invited to present at the CCO Metrics and Scoring Technical Advisory Group, as well as the Medicaid Advisory Committee Oral Health Work Group. And this will be incorporated into some of those final reports that will be coming out. We will also be presenting this to the full CCO Metrics and Scoring Committee in December. As I mentioned, we have three additional work groups. These work groups have not been around as long and have not been able to finalize as much of the work as the two previous groups have. They include our pharmacy, which is our most geographically diverse work group, composed of CCO pharmacy directors representing 14 of 16 CCOs throughout 2016. This group is focused on high-cost emerging medications and the potential effect that increasing pharmacy spending has on the ability for a CCO to effectively manage population health in their communities. The Social Determinants of Health Work Group is composed of a variety of FQHCs, advocates, and CCOs focusing on how to bridge the gap between the delivery of health care and the basic services such as food and housing that impact health outside the medical setting. And the State and Federal Regulatory Affairs is our newest work group. This group is populated by a variety of public policy and government relations representatives from around the state to discuss legislative concepts related to coordinated care in Oregon. Our CCO Oregon work groups continue to convene and work towards furthering health transformation in a coordinated care model. Our transparent, collaborative, and consensus-based policy development is a process we choose to utilize, which requires thoughtful dialogue to ensure high-quality work that will promote health in Oregon and work towards achievement of the triple aim. We are encouraged that our work in the dental and the IBAHOW has been considered valuable resources in Oregon and that those products are being referenced and incorporated into a variety of programs. We hope this will continue throughout our other work groups in the coming years. Thank you again for allowing us the opportunity to present today. We're available for any questions or comments.
Questions? Thank you so much for taking the time and presenting this. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up Lynn Saxton, the Oregon Health Authority, giving us an update.
And Bob Junda.
And Bob Junda. From Disability Rights Oregon.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz. We are pleased to be here today. It's a privilege for me to be joined by Bob, who I've known and worked with for decades now, I think, that long. And to update you on the Behavioral Health Collaborative, the Behavioral Health Mapping Tool, and Bob, of course, is a member of the Collaborative and can give you a perspective beyond my own. The Collaborative was established this year to produce an actionable plan by December that builds on the and accelerates the successes we've experienced using the coordinated care model. As you all know, when we began coordinated care, the concept was to integrate physical health, behavioral health, and oral health, both to drive efficiency but also to produce better outcomes for clients. And this Collaborative is energized by that concept and has been in its preliminary meetings very successful in identifying some of the gaps in service integration, access, and quality that we need to address for Oregonians as we go forward. The collaborative includes approximately 50 members representing a range of stakeholders from consumers, advocates, counties, CCOs, service delivery providers, clinicians, physicians, education, the public safety system, the courts, and housing, as well as other state agencies and social services. We have begun this work, although we've put some interesting and perhaps controversial straw person models on the table to provoke conversation. We have no foregone conclusion that we are driving towards, nor any preconceived notion of what counties and CCOs and other stakeholders' roles will be as we go forward. Diana Bianco is our facilitator, and we've also contracted with the Eugene S. Farley Jr. Health Policy Center from Colorado with Dr. Benjamin Miller, who has led efforts in other states to facilitate improved behavioral health care integration. The intent was to meet about two times each month, and we began aggressively in the summer in Oregon, never the best time to convene people, but nonetheless, we got some of the preliminary work out of the way during the summer months, and so far we've had four meetings. The first meetings focused on a review of the behavioral health mapping tool, which introduced some of the data sets we needed to revise and upgrade. As you know, the behavioral health mapping tool has a technical advisory committee of statewide participants, about 20 strong, who are people expert in both data and behavioral health data in particular, to ensure that the quality of that data is as strong as it can possibly be. In addition, Dr. Miller brings a lot of experience and tools from both Farley Center and other states as far as how to use and update behavioral health data in a national best practice manner. So the tool, which we began building a year ago, is in an improved state, but will be in a continuous improvement state till we get it to the point that we're all satisfied with it. I would underscore that it has lots of usable data now that we will begin to bring forward our recommendations to you in December. We also focused in these first meetings on the review of Oregon's performance plan with the U.S. Department of Justice to address the needs specifically of the 30,000-member adult population in Oregon with SPMI. The group has been asked to agree on a problem statement to inform a conceptual framework and react to scenarios about how the behavioral health system might be administered. As I mentioned previously, we've had some fairly heated conversations so far, and we hope to have more in the future as we look at the specific engineering of the system that we have in Oregon, the outcomes for the people we serve, and what we can collectively do to look at that system and bring it into the 21st century. In the weeks ahead, the specific areas our efforts will focus upon are, first, payment and finance. We will recognize and link to existing development efforts, such as our waiver work and the work on Senate Bill 231, and we'll also look at the various cost structures currently in the behavioral health system, among which there are some very strong crisis points in our current system. We'll also be looking at the workforce. We'll work to the Oregon Health Policy Board's existing work on workforce and focus on specifically on behavioral health workforce issues and be informed by the data we have in our own analytics department. As many of you know, there are critical gaps across the state in the behavioral health workforce. Next, we'll be looking at data. I've already mentioned the behavioral health mapping work and the work the Farley Center will play in improving beyond what we've already built in Oregon. We're very excited about that. We've seen already a different look at the problem because we're looking at data county by county using both the outcomes, the populations, and the financing data, which we have not had previously compiled in one place. We'll be looking at system roles. We began that discussion at the last meeting, and we'll continue to look at that. We have a category called waste. I think I'd prefer to call it efficiency, but either title will work, and we're going to use quality improvement expertise to assist in identifying opportunities to improve efficiency within the delivery system, which is key to both the integration to physical and oral health, but is also key to getting the needs met of the Oregonians who use the behavioral health system we have. And finally, and most importantly, we'll be looking at outcomes, and we'll be looking at outcomes with a client focus, not a process focus. We'll be bringing in our metrics manager as well as other staff tasked with the Oregon Performance Plan metrics. Again, to Senator Cruz's earlier question, we're working very hard to not build more metrics, but to simply have the right metrics and to integrate them as best as possible. By November, we expect that policy, finance, and infrastructure recommendations will be drafted. These recommendations will then be presented to the Oregon Health Policy Board for their consideration. Two meetings have been identified in December to conclude the work, finalizing our proposals. With that, I'm going to stop. I'm happy to answer any questions, either about the behavioral health mapping tool construction, which began a year ago, or about the collaborative itself.
The only question I have is, when will we be actually having data?
That
could be presented to us.
Couple of things. You will have data on the recommendations of the collaborative in December.
In December. Okay.
Data about the behavioral system as it currently exists in Oregon is available now, and I'd be happy, my staff would be happy to meet with you collectively or individually to review that data.
Yeah, that would be great. I would like that after the election. But
okay.
Yeah. Just to see
yes.
what's happening.
It's fascinating.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I am a member of the collaborative, and I want to thank Ms. Saxton and folks who work at Oregon Health Authority for bringing Disability Rights Oregon in and our perspective to this. As you know, we are client advocates, and so oftentimes we see the failures of the system, and we come from the focus of individuals who need services and have experienced difficulty in getting those services. And so we believe that our perspective is very important. In addition, I think it's important to mention that we don't receive any funding through the state's mental health system. And so we believe that we bring an objective view that's specifically from the client's perspective. I just wanted to give you a quick sense of the way that I see this process and why I think this process is absolutely essential to moving forward on mental health policy in Oregon. Like the members of this committee, I've been working on mental health advocacy for a long time, and I know this committee certainly has, and there's been a lot of frustration over the years in terms of understanding what the people of Oregon are receiving for their mental health dollar. We invest a lot of resources into this area, and sometimes what the public sees is people in the streets, people in our jails, people who are not getting the benefit of those services. This particular planning process is at a critical point in my view, and I'll tell you why. As you know, we have made some very large structural changes to how we move our money for mental health services. Mental health was moved, in a sense, into the physical health realm through a process called integration, where monies were moved into our new CCOs in an effort to achieve health outcomes for an entire community. And those health outcomes were to not only address physical health, but mental health and chemical dependency needs, understanding that they are related. And so we took it upon ourselves to put money into the CCO system with the expectation that those services would be better integrated. What we have seen from the consumer end is that in some areas that has moved forward, in some areas it hasn't moved forward at all. So we've had limited progress in terms of that type of integration, where an individual who's on Medicaid can have an expectation to get a full range of health services that will assist them in staying out of crisis staying in their communities, not bringing crisis home to their families, and being able to continue to be productive. So given our limited success in doing that in the overall health arena, where do we go from here? We still have a fragmented mental health system. That's the term that has traditionally been applied to the mental health system. It continues to be fragmented. We have mental health dollars going to a variety of places, but how do we coordinate them? How do we make sure that people get the care that they need when they need it? And how do we use our money efficiently? We know that having people in our state hospital, having people in jail and prison, is not an efficient use of our public resources. So where do we go from here? We have a longstanding policy of moving money to counties to use money for certain purposes. Is that the best use of our funds? Should we have money going to different places to in order to achieve the same goals? That's something that we need to study and understand. And we need to have good data in order to evaluate it. One of the things that our system has, again, I know we have all shared this frustration of knowing what is our data showing and how is it resulting in results for our community. I wanted to just share one little story about this, which is exemplary of the concern that I bring to the process. And this has just happened this week. And Senator Cruz, it's from your jurisdiction, your area, is an individual who right now is in the Douglas County Jail, even though everyone in the public service system, that is the courts, the sheriff, the mental health system, the state hospital system, know this individual and understand that he has a serious mental illness. And yet, because of a lack of coordinated care, because of a clear handoff between criminal justice system and mental health, he's back in the jail basically because no one knows where else for him to go. His needs are not punishing this gentleman is not going to achieve any goal for anyone. What this gentleman needs is a good wraparound mental health service in his community. And I talked to the presiding judge in that county who said, we just don't have it. This is a waste of our resources. It's a waste of our community well-being. And it's the type of thing that we really need to be drilling down and saying, are we using our money efficiently and effectively? And so I'm very happy to be on this committee. I think that it's happening at a critical moment where we have an important decision to make. And that's what I have to say.
Thank you, Bob, so much. Thanks, Lynn. Okay. Senator Knoll.
First of all, thank you both for what you do. Lynn, my question has to do with testimony earlier from the nurses in the hospitals relating to the overtime issue. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of that issue and the issue they're having with OHA trying to, since they've come to an agreement, which it should be a headline-grabbing event, nurses and hospitals agree on overtime management. Are you aware of the issue, and is there a resolution that could be done by rule?
So I am aware of the issue. I have several questions following the testimony this morning that I want to follow up with both our state hospital and my team, but I'm optimistic there can be a resolution.
Great. Can you would you let maybe the committee know?
Yes.
Of that, because I know we're all very interested in that. This is an issue that's been going on quite a while.
Yes, so. Senator Knope, I will do so.
Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. This is an aside, but I think it actually ties in with what Mr. Jindiff was saying. One of the issues I think we need to consider is how previous interactions with the criminal justice system are affecting access to treatment. I was meeting with the Multnomah County Community Justice, Department of Community Justice, and with the public defenders over the past few weeks doing some follow-up on the 3194 justice reinvestment work. And one of the stories they told me was about a gentleman who clearly states he has an alcohol addiction, clearly states he wants treatment, has been in community court on average 100 times a year for open container violations and yet can't get into an alcohol treatment program because he had one sex offense conviction 40 years ago. Mm. We got a problem. Mm-hmm. When you got somebody who wants treatment, who's costing the system that much money, and yet we have so limited treatment that they can discriminate based on one conviction 40 years ago. So I think we really need to have some serious conversations about those kinds of issues and how we need to work with our treatment programs and our facilities to say, can't do it. I heard a similar story about a lady who became combative after a head injury, and she has a shunt to treat hydrocephalus, and because she ended up being combative against a police officer, ended up in jail. Well, she was combative because she had increased intracranial pressure, and now no nursing facility will take her because this is not in Oregon, it's in Washington as it happens, but it could happen here, I think. No nursing physician facility will take her because she has a criminal conviction. And it just boggles the mind.
Senator Steiner Hayward, Chair Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, there are multiple cases like that, as we all know, and it is really critical that we look at solutions. I will say that in addition to the collaborative, which has a very aggressive work schedule, and we appreciate everyone's time because it's intense, we are also working with the through our work with the state hospital and the counties with the 370 population, which is often the cases that you're mentioning, and with the Department of Justice to see what we can do in the near term to address those needs in new and different ways. And I will say that the district attorneys and the circuit court judges have been very creative and helpful in saying, could we stop doing this and start doing that to get people out of going into court to get their mental health problems solved. So I don't have the solution in hand. I can't give you the data today that shows we are where we need to be, but we are hard on it. And it is an issue that has reached. I've heard crisis used a lot here this morning, so I'm not going to use that language, but has reached very serious proportions in Oregon, and we hope to have solutions in the near term.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
I don't want this panel to be excused without talking about the fact that we also have a massive brick-and-mortar problem as far as facilities for these people, not just programs, but facilities for these people, which is why they end up in jail, because there's no other place for them. So that's something that needs to be addressed as well.
And just a note there, just as a minor commercial, Senator Cruz, if I may, we have the 2015 legislative session allocated $20 million to mental health funding housing supports, and only $6 million of those funds have been applied for to date. So we are here standing ready with $14 million to help with bricks and mortar, or as I occasionally say to people, since we build this product in Oregon, manufactured housing also is a very real opportunity mm-hmm. for the population and can be built in shorter periods of time.
And if I could add, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, part of the U.S. Department of Justice mm-hmm. agreement with the state is about creating more housing options mm-hmm. that have supports that come out to the individual to make sure that their situation is stable and they are not being cut loose, like the individual I mentioned in Rosebud, who was actually ended up in jail because he was evicted from a motel room and went back because he had no other housing option and was found to be trespassing. This is exactly the type of problem that we need to address through good housing options and supports for people, much less expensive than large hospitals, at a level that people need in order to maintain in the community and not lose their living skills, but with some clinical help and supervision and support to allow them to live in their communities. We have a framework for that in this Department of Justice agreement, which is good. Mm-hmm. We obviously need to step up and do it. One of the structural and legal difficulties in Oregon is that our state department Oregon Health Authority, does not provide services. It does not order people or providers to provide services. We have a very decentralized type of system, and there need to be the proper incentives and funding to bring these services up to speed. So we do have an agreement, which is really great, but with your support and community support, we can make it happen.
Yeah. And I agree with that, and I'm glad that the feds are finally putting a little more pressure on, because that's helpful, I personally think. But I would also suggest that at the community level, there is many times a reluctance to jump into something, because many, many, many times the state offers something, the communities buy into it, and then it disappears, and they're left holding an empty bag. So, you know, there's a lot of trust issues here we have to deal with as well.
Thank you. All right. The Oregon Health Systems Transformation Quarterly Legislative Report, and Leslie Clement, Mark Fairbanks, and Jeremy Vandehay. Okay, Jeremy. Go
it feels
for
like
it.
Every time I show up, Sandy's shaking her head at me.
That's right. Jeremy's got to go first.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehay, Governor's Health Policy Advisor, thank you for the opportunity to parachute in for 2-3 minutes very quickly on the topic of transformation and the waiver. I had some news I wanted to share with you and just give you a real quick update before Mark and Leslie dive into the quarterly report. Just for background, as you know, we have a 1115 demonstration waiver that expires next year. We've been in conversations with CMS since March, at least that I've been involved with, around that renewal
process. When was the
first
waiver?
1994.
That's what I thought. Okay.
I was not around for that one.
Neither was I. So.
But I'm quickly learning all about waivers. You know, it doesn't expire until next year. We've been in sort of this awkward position where you have to apply 6-12 months in advance, but it doesn't actually expire until next year, and have had a number of positive conversations with CMS about their excitement around the work we've accomplished in transformation and wanting to be able to continue to work with us, but we really haven't been on a 2016 work plan because they have other waivers and other work that is expiring this year. We've made a lot of progress over the last couple of months with CMS. The waiver application is now out for a public comment period this summer and is now in. CMS has already begun working on some of the policy areas of it. One of the areas that we'd asked them to prioritize is this issue around flexible services, which is be able to make some investments on non-traditional medical services and how those get counted. Right now they're getting counted in terms of the global budgets as admin, and so we wanted to correct that so that CCOs are incented to be able to make those investments as the same way that they would other types of medical services. And we've Lori Coyner is not here today, but I will do a little bit of bragging on her behalf. She's done a great amount of work with CMS the last couple of months, and we actually think we're pretty close to wrapping up that piece right out of the gate. But what I provided you today is a letter that we received from CMS yesterday, just affirming their general support for CCOs and the work the state has done around health system transformation, that they're really encouraged around the progress that they've seen to date and are excited to work collaboratively with us on the renewal process. They've chunked out the work into buckets, kind of policy areas. This is not an exhaustive list, but kind of shows how they're thinking about timeline, and their goal is to work through as much of it as they can by the end of the year. That's not to say that we're going to land exactly in the same place that we apply. As you know, this is somewhat of a negotiation, but we're really excited to see the work plan in place. The work around social determinants and the proposal to create coordinated health partnerships and make better connections between CCOs and jails and housing, and really go into Mr. Jundef's story. That's where we're really trying to take CCOs on the next level, is to go out sort of one level out and bridge some of those connections with other systems and provide some more flexibility and within the Medicaid rules and how you can do that. We're really pushing them farther than they've gone with other states, but they've signaled excitement to be able to go there with Oregon. That will come towards the end of the process, as you'll see in the letter, as well as the conversations that we would like to have with them around shared savings. But we're really excited today just to see their affirmation of the work that we've done, that they continue to point to Oregon as a potential model for other states. And I just just wanted to share that with you today.
Thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate it. Yes,
just one thing I know, in conversations months ago with Senator Bates, we were getting, it depended on who you talked to at CMS as to, they were kind of here and here at the same time. Are they kind of coming together on this stuff, or are you still, the responses you're getting dependent on who you talk to in any particular day?
Well, I think, Senator Cruz, I think there's still the sort of push and pull around.
Right.
Their willingness to, how far they're willing to go with the Medicaid program and feeling like they don't need to, they shouldn't be the ones that are funding everything in the entire world. But I think that's evolving. There's a growing level, there's a growing body of evidence that moving into social determinants has a bigger impact on health, and I think they recognize that, and we need to help build out some of that policy direction with them over time. A lot of the folks that we will be working with as we go deeper into the actual policy work is the career level folks who, you know, won't be affected by this transition. And so, that's kind of where we need to have those conversations right now, is move some of those folks along.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Okay. Now Leslie and Mark can come up.
We're going to have Justin drive.
Okay. And Justin. All right.
We all get lost.
Let's see.
Okay. Well, good morning. It's been a very interesting to hear all the presentations. I'm Leslie Clement. I'm the Director of Health Policy and Analytics at the Oregon Health Authority. With me here is
Mark Fairbanks. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority.
So we don't have a PowerPoint per se. What we have is the very first quarterly report that the Oregon Health Authority has compiled to respond to the legislative direction that's been in statute that had asked OHA to routinely update and inform you all about the success and progress of our health system transformation and the work being done by CCOs. The report is organized to get results to inform you and other stakeholders of where we are and how we've been doing, both in terms of the good news and also in terms of indicators about where we might be able to improve. So I'm just going to ask Justin to flip the page here and show you the different areas. We added a section on the Oregon Health Plan demographics to give you a sense of who's receiving services under the Oregon Health Plan. We have a small section on our CCO performance on quality metrics. You all receive a huge comprehensive report on our CCO metrics and their performance. This is a snapshot that, to give you the latest updates. There is an appendix if you want the full report with all the progress in that area. We have a member satisfaction section that's mostly the result of surveys that we administer. We do an annual one. We give you some information on health disparities of our population. And then Mark is going to really take you through the finance section. Candidly, this is probably the piece of the report that will be the most new to you. You've probably have seen bits and pieces of the report in other formats, but the finance, even though we have a lot of this data on our website, I don't think you've ever seen it in quite this way. We have a section on our patient-centered primary care homes. We did want to highlight that because we think that's such a foundational piece of our health system transformation, and you heard this morning various discussions about CPC Plus and Senate Bill 231, and so we wanted to share what's happening there. We've had some evaluations to date. Some of them were very preliminary. We summarized the results of those evaluations. We talk about the local governance pieces that that were established under CCOs. We talk about our eligibility and enrollment system. That's how we're progressing in terms of completing applications and our redeterminations. And finally, we give you a snapshot of the administrative rules that have taken place and try to highlight some of those areas for your information of maybe where there have been some concerns. So with that, I want to just page forward. First of all, I want to ask, do you have any questions about the nature of the report at this point? Okay. Why don't you go to the Oregon Health Plan demographic page? So you heard from KEPRO earlier today that about the fee-for-service population that they manage. The rest of the population is managed by our coordinated care organizations. The individuals, the people who are under fee-for-service, you can see on a bar chart here that about 46,000 of those individuals are in fee-for-service because they have other primary commercial health insurance. And we are talking to the CCOs right now about whether we should continue to exclude them from CCO enrollment or whether they believe that they could coordinate the care with another carrier. And so there is some momentum there. I think our overall objective is if we believe the coordinated care model is working well for Oregon, then we want the most amount of members enrolled in those CCOs. The other area that has about 33,000 individuals are what we call dually eligible. So those are individuals that are eligible for Medicaid as well as Medicare. Some of them are eligible for Medicare because of disabilities, and some of them are eligible for Medicare because of age. We have a waiver request in our renewal application to change our current system from an opt-in, which means an individual on application is asked whether they'd like to choose to go into a CCO, to an opt-out, which would automatically enroll them into a CCO, and if they chose they didn't like it, they could opt out. There's others that there's about 25,000 we think that could be in CCOs. We're going to do a deep dive on that to better understand who that population is. And then some just will always have an exemption from CCOs. And then the tribes also have the right to choose not to participate in CCOs. The map at the bottom really gives you a snapshot in Oregon by county of the overall percentage of their county population that is enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And that ranges from Benton, which is a low of about 16%, up to the highest percent of Medicaid in Josephine County. So obviously there's some significant differences throughout the state, but we've got 1.1 million people in the Oregon Health Plan today. Next slide. In terms of the demographics about who is in the Oregon Health Plan, you'll see that OHP members tend to be, that overall population tends to be more diverse than the overall state demographics. I don't think there's anything else to say about that. The next page, it gives you some information. Often individuals are interested in, you know, what income qualifies them to participate in the program. Historically, it's been true that children can be eligible at much higher incomes than adults. That's true today. With the ACA expansion, the Medicaid expansion, by far the biggest change in our OHP demographics is we now have more adults in our Oregon Health Plan than we do children, and that's because adults now can qualify on the basis of income only. And historically, since Medicaid was stood up in 1965, they had to be categorically eligible. So they had to have something else going on, a disability, they had to be pregnant, they had some other condition that would qualify them above and beyond income. With the ACA expansion and those eligibility rules, now it can be just income, and that has inflated our enrollment. I wanted to also share a little information. There's a pie chart at the bottom of this page that just shows you in terms of employment. And I think that's really important to highlight, that this population is primarily working and working full-time, but working at such low wages that they still qualify for the program. And please feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions.
You're doing fine, yeah.
Really fast, though, two things. The first is, so if they're working at such low wages, the chances that they're working for a company that's big enough to be required to provide benefits under the ACA are high. Mm-hmm. So why are they not getting benefits through their company? It's because of their income? Or help me understand that piece.
So if they qualify for Medicaid, That's their first opportunity. I mean, they don't have to purchase other commercial health insurance. There also could be a cost sharing consideration there. So it may not be that their employer is not offering coverage. It may be that it's with high deductibles and it's too expensive.
If I may, Madam Chair, this is kind of important. You know, 2 years ago, we passed legislation that required the health authority to work with the Department of Employment to talk about how many people in Oregon were working 20 to 29 hours a week for a company big enough that they should be providing benefits for people working more than 30 hours a week. Turns out that number is something on the order of 79,000 people, mm-hmm. and that doesn't even include all the people who are being affected as family members of those. Mm-hmm. So you take that population plus the three-quarters of OHP members who are working, the non-elderly adults who are working full-time, right. and I start to wonder about the state picking up an awful lot of expense for companies. And what I don't know, and I have to get some more information about and ask, is whether there are ways to do a shared model. If Medicaid's the most effective way to get care for these people, but companies are supposed to be providing health insurance, maybe they ought to be picking up the state's contribution for Medicaid at the very least, and it would be probably a heck of a lot cheaper for them than whatever contribution they're doing. And I think we need to be considering blending models a little bit. And the second point, Madam Chair, is, you know, the letter that Mr. Vandehay gave us talks about CMS's concern about tribal uncompensated care and care coordination for our Native American population. You pointed out that they can choose whether they participate in CCOs or not. Mm-hmm. How do you mesh those two points together? Because if people don't choose to participate, they have that right, and they can participate in the Indian Health Plan.
Right.
But I don't know how CMS is going to hold us accountable for that if we're supposed to be taking care of that as well.
So the first point's about employment. I think that we can have some conversations with our DCBS partner about what possible shared models there may be. The second point about tribal members and is that there is some interest. So some tribal services are 100% matched today. There is an opportunity that's being explored right now to actually get other services that weren't eligible for 100% federal match covered. There is some work that is also being done with tribal entities and CCOs to try to figure out how they can work together, whether there can be some contractual arrangements. A big issue for the tribes have been, or tribal members, is really access to specialty services because of the low reimbursement rate. So there's a number of policy pieces underway that I think will actually address some of the access issues, at the same time address the underlying funding source issues. So I think we're moving in a good direction with that.
Thank you, Ms. Lund. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I'm not going to spend a great deal again on the quality metrics. I think you can see that, and I think our staff that work in the metrics management area of the CCOs has really actually been surprised and pleased at the continuing positive results and performance that the CCOs have made on the 17 metrics that are financially incentivized. And you can see that for the most part, most of our CCOs have met all those metrics. I'm going to flip to the next page quickly, and I don't want to take up too much more time. The good news is, I think you've heard this historically, is we're doing a really good job at reducing avoidable emergency department utilization. Where we need to do a better job is really working on these dental sealants, and we also need to do a better job of instituting alcohol and drug treatment. I'll flip to the next page, and this is just one.
And I am proposing some legislation. I'm not needing to keep it a secret that we expand the scopes of any medical provider with proper training could have sealants, could apply a sealants.
And I think,
or at least fluoride sealants.
That's great, and I think that's probably an area. This was an area that a metric that was established after the first round. So it was like, okay, how can we start making some progress in oral health? And I know you heard from the other presenters. There's a lot more to look at in that area. I wanted to bring out an area that I think that. Talks about where we need to really focus attention and move the dial more, and that is with our populations that have disabilities, mental health diagnoses, as well as those with serious and persistent mental health. You can see in this page, it's on page 12, we've got some serious utilization issues with people who have mental health diagnoses, and they are using the emergency room at such a high rate of utilization. So in the aggregate, we're reducing ED usage, but when you tease out these particular individuals, you can see we still need to make progress. So we have to wrap up at 11, right?
Well, we have one more presenter
behind you.
Okay. So I'm going to pause and just say, as you read through this report, and if you have any questions at all and suggestions about things that you'd like to see that you're not seeing, this is the very first one. So we want to learn from you, get your feedback, and the next report will be coming out in January. So I just want to welcome that. And then I want to turn over the rest of my time to Mark to take you through the financial section. It's great. Okay.
Senator Montes-Anderson, excuse me, committee. Once again, I'm Mark Fairbanks, and Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority. Beginning on page 16 of our report is probably the section most glossed over, the financial section. Don't get a lot of interest in this particular area, but I'll walk you through it and really highlight a couple of things. We're going to talk about, or we display here, 2013 through 2015 information. As Leslie pointed out, this report, this is our first go. We have organized this into sections displaying what is the CCO profile, what do they look like, who are they, how are they structured, what does their general ownership structure look like. We're going to talk a little bit in here about CCO margins. We're going to talk about the mechanisms that CMS calls the risk mitigation lever, known as MLR, and its associate to the medical services ratio. Talk a little bit about capitalization of the CCOs and touch on rate development, and some brief comments on risks and pressures we're seeing as we push forward for developing 2017 rates for the CCOs and beyond. So the first thing you'll notice on page 16 is we have listed out all of the CCOs, all 16 of them, and their corporate status and description of the parent slash owner of these entities. Certainly was not here in the early days, but I surmise that this organization was designed to attract community-specific providers to deliver services. Healthcare is very local, and certainly our model recognizes that, and also to attract business models to vet best practices and innovation within the system. Again, this is based on what was set in what is current law in terms of what how CCOs are allowed to exist within our system and how they contract with us to provide services. So I would like to also point out that as I go through this, that we are looking at, my team is looking at, in conjunction with Leslie and others and Lori Coyner, the and our CCOs themselves, the different models. Now that we have going on 3+ years worth of experience and we're in flight, we want to start looking at the attributes of success, the attributes that are more struggling and problematic, and we are continuing to evolve our financial reporting for the CCOs, as I'll talk about a little bit as we go through this report, to provide more visibility to this various tapestry here of ownership and structure. So in that, with that said, I'll move along to operating margins. And on page 17, we have a section here that describes from 2013 through 15 and a little bit beyond the profile of operating margins of the various CCOs. I think the most important thing, there's a lot of good data here, concisely done, I believe, but the most important event to really notice here that we talked about last we met in some detail is 2014 and the advent of an ACA population. And the immense, I guess, pressure and invisibility it brought to how rates are being developed, how rates match to risk. And certainly, we had a population that was more than double of what we expected hit the system. And those rates were developed with a lack of trending and a lack of good historical data. There were a lot of assumptions. And nationally, we find that ACA rates for 2014 for the expansion population were too high. So we have gone through at CCO request and also at in cooperation with CMS's desire, a new rate model. That model was vetted and fully developed and described to the committee last August. And that was approved by CMS, as has its next iteration into 2016. 2017 rates are in development, and those rates will be given to the CCOs for their 60-day review and to CMS for their 90-day review sometime in early October, actually by October 1st.
And how transparent can you be on how you go about setting rates with the CCOs?
Well, Senator Montes Anderson and the committee, I believe that our protocol for engaging the CCOs with base data, the data comes from them. It comes to our actuarial services unit. We work with Optimus, our contract actuary, for actuarial soundness and for certification. And the process is very rigorous. There are meetings held virtually weekly, sometimes every day. They are with CCOs one-on-one. They are with groups. And there's a great...
So you do meet with each CCO?
Yes, we meet with each CCO. We go through their data. We go through regional data. And we, if you think about it, we start at the top with gathering all of the base information. It's really important to note that rates are developed based on the actual costs of providing a service. They are not being driven by budget. They are not being driven by any other mechanism such as MLR. Rates stand by themselves based on the analysis of what it is costing to deliver services. And then from that, there is a very robust level of analytics that come to bear to assign risk to the population, and then through that base data to make sure that the risk profile of the population is in effect matched to the rate. That's the rate range, in our case, that is developed by Optimus.
Is this process different than what DCBS goes through with its rate review?
I can't speak exactly to the commercial side of the rate making, but I would imagine that it is somewhat different. I'd have to let Pat Allen or Laura Calley really speak to that detail.
I don't know if we're all different or not.
I know that things like MLR are very common in the insurance industry across the board, in health insurance, commercial, and in Medicaid and public options. MLR is a pretty well-used mechanism. I know that DCBS also requires for the licensure, you know, approval of health plans. NAIC standards for reporting, those are nationally recognized for insurance companies. Those reporting standards are based on risk-based capital and other metrics that are actually a little bit more rigorous, arguably, than we need to require.
I'm sorry, I don't want to belabor this.
No problem.
We have another
so let me take you to, I'll go quick. I'll make a couple of comments. On page 18, I like this chart because you can lay side by side for each year, for each CCO, the operating margin and the total margins. Now, typically, you would find and expect that while total margins can be higher than an operating margin, so you've got your capitated rate, you've got your direct cost of care, and then you have your non-medical or non-operating costs. In a couple of cases, you'll find there's variability here, although in the composite of the aggregate, we're tracking pretty closely to what we see across the country. 2015 is a composite average of 5% margin. We see that in the case of a couple of our CCOs in 2015, they actually had higher operating margins than or most of them had lower total operating margins than operating margins, but some had higher. And I think that I want to call out that variability. There are things that impact the CCOs in this model that have to do with taxation, that have to do with settlement activity, investment activity, grants, and that may cause total margin to be larger than the operating margin. Medical services ratio. Medical services ratio is slightly different than MLR, which is the medical loss ratio. The medical loss ratio is defined by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS. It starts with the medical services ratio, but adds such things as health care quality improvement expenses and in 2017, fraud prevention expenses. So there are more expenses in the MLR than the MSR. But in our experience so far, the differences between the two are quite small. So we display the medical services ratio and the medical loss ratio for your information. So you can see basically through 13 through 15, the dollars spent on care as a proportion of the capitated rate delivered to the CCOs. Again, you're going to notice some volatility in those numbers and some changes because of the effect of the expansion population in 2014. On page 20, we summarize for you the capitalization, the net assets on page 21. Again, in a comparative side-by-side basis, and to normalize these, we show it by member and in total dollars to the right, by member to the left, so that they're more comparable. And note that the white marker on the right side of this particular page indicates where the minimum requirement is for net worth, and that is at 5% of the CCO's average annual defined revenue. On rate development, I already touched on that. We've noticed, this is a go-forward comment for 2017 development, that some of the incentive payments that have flown through the system relating to prior years need to be what I call normalized so that we do not overstate or put too much pressure on the growth rate beyond our 3.4% annual budgetary ceiling. And with all that said, we're also noticing some phenomenon that I think has already been somewhat discussed in various settings. Pharmaceutical costs continue to go up rapidly, and we're seeing that, and we're having to deal with those pressures within our rate making. Also, we have, of course, some expanded benefits and treatments for Hep C, back pain, and others that are also putting some pressure on costs for our CCOs. But all that said, the waiver, as Jeremy pointed out, still commits to 3.4% going forward. Certainly, the waiver is designed to help us facilitate that by some specific mechanisms. But I wanted to compliment my colleagues in the CCOs, certainly all of the financial groups, and the CEOs for all of their participation, all of their commentary, all of the dialogue, and all the hard work. Because for all of its perhaps less than perfect attributes that we are learning, the CCO model is their solvent, they're producing, and I think we see some pretty notable results.
Thank you. With that, I'm not going to take questions, although I would love to spend some more time on this. But Susan Otter, can you come on up and give your technology report?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Otter. I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm pleased to present to you today on the first annual report to the legislature on the Oregon Health IT Program as mandated by House Bill 2294, which was passed in 2015. So we have a new status report we're giving you every year. It's in your materials that are on OLIS, and we include in the report some description about the health information technology environment in Oregon, some specific activities that we have underway, and some upcoming efforts that we're engaged in. As you know, health information technology impacts nearly every aspect of coordinated care. We heard about the need for technology and care coordination, particularly the emergency department information exchange and the great use that we've seen of that, that was mentioned by the CCO Oregon Dental Work Group, and the accompanying software pre-manage, which was mentioned by KeyPro, and we're bringing to our CCOs in Oregon. So in order to have the deliver on the coordinated care model, the health information technology infrastructure is really necessary to be able to share information, bring a analytics tools for assessing outcomes and quality, and tools and applications for patients to better manage their own health. OHA and others are investing in health information technology in Oregon. We've leveraged state and federal funding to invest in our strategic planning efforts, our statewide health information technology services, and grant funds to pilot innovative approaches in areas such as telehealth. Our Medicaid coordinated care organizations also are investing in health information technology. With the transformation funds that were granted by the legislature, all of our CCOs spent some of their funds in new technology tools, regional health information exchanges, population management tools, or other technology that allows them to assess the quality and the care for their members. In Oregon, 74% of physicians have adopted certified electronic health records and benefited from the Medicaid or Medicare electronic health record incentive programs. And all Oregon hospitals have also adopted certified electronic health records. Those EHRs really form the basis of health information technology in Oregon, and we're seeing some great results from those. One of the most exciting events that we've been able to support in Oregon is, as I mentioned, the Emergency Department Information Exchange and Pre-Manage. That connects all Oregon hospitals for their emergency department and inpatient event data to the data already available from the Washington emergency departments across the Washington hospitals. Those data are available and collected real-time from Oregon and Washington hospitals and made available back to our Oregon emergency departments when they have a member that's been a high utilizer of emergency department services. Pre-Manage is the tool that sits on top of Eddy. It's just a view into the same data that's available through Eddy. And that's a tool that's being used by 8 of our 16 CCOs currently, over 150 clinic sites, and other commercial health plans to look at the emergency department and inpatient events for their members or patients. We're seeing some really exciting results with that in terms of the ability for health plans, CCOs, and primary care providers to follow up right away when one of their members has a hospital event and to better manage their populations that are at risk for high utilization of emergency department use. OHA is leveraging federal funding to bring the pre-managed tool to our Medicaid care coordinators in Oregon. We have 75% federal match for a two-year subscription to pre-manage and are subsidizing or covering the cost for our CCOs that choose to use that tool. KeyPro, as well as some other care coordinators, are assertive community treatment teams in Oregon, and we're piloting with our long-term care field offices to bring the pre-managed tool to those folks. CCOs and other health plans are also covering the costs of clinics for their pre-managed subscriptions, and we have EMS, behavioral health, primary care, and others that are actively using pre-managed today to manage those their populations. The Medicaid EHR incentive program brings, and the Medicare EHR incentive program brings over $400 million in federal incentive payments to Oregon to date. We have all 60 hospitals and more than 7,400 Oregon-eligible professionals that have accessed those funds. And that, again, supports the adoption of certified electronic health records to form that basis. We have other major activities that have gone on this year that I won't go through each one. I'll just mention that we're in the process of implementing three new technology services, the Common Credentialing Program, which will we've completed our procurement for that program and have a vendor selected, and we're on track to implement that program in 2017. The provider directory, which we are have closed the procurement for that and are in the process of evaluating responses and are on track to implement that program by the end of 2017 or early 2018. The provider directory will leverage the excellent data in the Common Credentialing Program, which will have about 55,000 Oregon practitioners' data in it. And then the third program is our Clinical Quality Metrics Registry that we're looking at. The procurement for that closes this week, and that will be implemented in early 2018 to collect the critical clinical data that we rely on for our CCO metrics, such as the diabetes poor control metrics, hypertension, and depression screening and follow-up that can only really come from an electronic health record or clinical data. We've invested in other initiatives. We've been able to bring federal grant funding to our Jefferson Health Information Exchange, which is one of several regionally based health information exchanges in Oregon. Jefferson HIE is, amongst other things, using that funding to focus on behavioral health information exchange and navigating the tricky consent waters around addiction treatment providers. We've also brought, as I mentioned, federal grant funding to telehealth pilots and supporting consumer access to their clinical records. We have a lot of great things coming up. We're working with the Public Health Department on implementing the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, Connection to Health Information Technology Services, that was approved with House Bill 4124 last year or earlier this year. And there are new federal funds to support bringing Medicaid providers onto health information exchange that we think will be critical to supporting behavioral health, corrections, and other providers as we look at the new concepts with our proposed waiver. So with that, I'll stop and see if there are any questions.
Question?
So exciting.
Thank you so very much for making it brief and concise and still covering all of the important points.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. With that, everyone, we are adjourned.